crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Good evening and welcome. Another broadcast week begins as we move into the meat of November. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. A little internet radio experiment that began 7 years and change ago. The 4 score and 7 years minus the 4 score. In an attempt to see if there wasn't a better way to exchange information within a radio-style format. What we came up with is a little something that we call conversation radio. It's long form. You're not going to hear any commercials on this program for Buy Gold Now or mattresses that were formulated because of our forays into space. No. No, there won't be any vacuum cleaner ads talking about the bowling balls that they can drop on those mattresses. What we have here is conversation. Occasionally punctuated by a little bit of music here and there. But the single most important part of this whole experiment is you. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. The Horn is available on a wide variety of internet platforms, including TuneIn Radio and Tuner Internet Radio, Stitcher Internet Radio, Dart.fm, and Streama.com, as well as Roku. The podcasts are available at WhiteRoseSociety.org under the Horn's subdomain. Head on with Bob Kincaid. The podcast address is there, and you can also get the podcast on iTunes. So we can go with you pretty much anywhere you need to go. And by all means, we encourage you to take us along. Tell us about the world where you are. Tell us what you're thinking. What's moving and inspiring and annoying you. Because this really is an exchange of information and ideas and feelings that is entirely unscripted and the greatest value.
I don't care about his sex life, but I did hear something very interesting. I read a story this morning that there is a woman in Georgia who was accusing the guy who's the chairman of the Waffle House of forcing her to have sex with him over 10 years as part of her job duties. Now, that I have a problem with, where the general puts his little general in someone who's perfectly, in fact, was his biographer. You know, they were running together and playing together. Yeah, that's fine. But when you're talking about this allegation, and I hope that this gets fully flushed out, because this is the kind of stuff that, well, where we used to be. And the weaker that our labor laws become and the more power that we give the wealth class, the upper echelon, the more this stuff it will hopefully come to light when it happens. Sad part of it, it's usually hushed up. It's usually paved with money. I'm hoping that this turns into something and people go, you know what? Hey, sex acts as a condition of employment. Sorry, not going there. But here again, what you've got is you've got, you know, someone in the wealth class who has this woman, you know, who has a kid, can't find other work, is struggling to make ends meet, and oh, hey, you know, you need the job, don't you? Well, you're going to have to do this or that. According to her, he made her go buy pornography, made her go buy lingerie and certain sex toys for him. I'm not sure what that means. She said that he also touched her inappropriately and made sexual comments to her. You look at this and you go, oh, what's the big deal? The big deal is between the two scenarios, I don't care about Petraeus and his little tryst because there was no power there. This reeks to me of a power situation where you have someone's life in the balance. So I'm going to be interested to see where this goes. But anyway, the big cliff, we're heading towards it. You know, Tuesday there was a lot of talk of maybe we're going to see some kind of kumbaya moment. You know, Congress will be, you know, holding hands, and there was hope. Come on, there was a little hope, right? And on Wednesday, when Boehner gave his speech with a teleprompter, didn't hear the right talk about the teleprompter when Boehner used it. In fact, the speech that he gave on Wednesday with the teleprompter, there were 17 drafts of. And you go, wow, he really wanted to make sure he got every word. And I wonder how many lawyers looked that over. So you say, oh, yeah, you could say this, and we can wiggle out of whatever it is you say. But as we move towards the fiscal cliff, and look, you know, I make light of it. The reality is there could be some fairly serious consequences if this goes throughout the whole year. And there's no one who thinks that's going to happen. Rational minds are going to have to come together and say, you know what, at least pass the tax breaks for the 98% so you don't collapse the economy. My fear is that you have Republicans who, you know, the same ones that held Boehner hostage in the last Congress, going to do it again this time. Because the CBO has said that if we don't do anything and the country goes off the fiscal cliff, if you will, and the all of the tax rates go up and the alternative minimum tax doesn't get fixed and all of the other, you know, draconian things, the sequestration, the cuts, all that stuff, unemployment would rise from where it is now, 7.9, up to 9.1. That's by the end of 2013. Now, that's not going to happen. But the CBO has also said, look, if you extend all of the tax cuts, you do all of it, give the rich people their tax cut, and you fix the alternative minimum tax, it would help to expand the economy by about 1.4% by the beginning of next year, about 1.4. But if you take away those tax cuts for the very wealthy, and we've talked about this already, it would add 1.3% to the GDP. So you're talking about a very small gain to give such enormous wealth to the top 2%. Money that we could use to pay down our debt, money that we could use to invest in roads and bridges, resources that we could use to, oh, I don't know, put broadband access across the country, invest in renewable energy, you know, transportation, you know, maybe fund schools, you know, a whole plethora of things we could do with the additional resources. And you know what? You know what it would do? It would put people back to work. And the president alluded to that in his little speech today, where he said, look, you know how, what we did in the 90s? Was we had the Clinton tax code, which raised that top marginal rate to 39.6 from the 35 where it is now. I mean, think about it. We've given 4.6% of the handouts out. Here you go, 4.6% for you. And did they do anything with it? I mean, constructive. Because we were told, if you remember, and I do, we were told that it was going to create jobs, there would be broad prosperity, and oh, everything would be wonderful, rivers full of gold and honey, and just it would be amazing. So we gave out $1.7 trillion, and where did it go? Well, to the very top. And what did it do? Well, we actually lost jobs. So why would I want to continue back to that? To me, and again, you know, I've talked about this before, the Clinton tax code, okay, that's a step. But we should be moving in the direction of the Eisenhower tax code. Full employment should be our goal in this country, one way or another. And if the private sector refuses, which they have done, and today we're going to talk about the number of companies that have laid people off because their candidate lost. Not because there's any rational reason, not because anything has happened in the 3 days since the election began to happen. No, because they can. And this is what happens when you give too much power and too much control to too few people. So the president talked about his plan to reduce the deficit over $4 trillion over the next decade. Said he wasn't wed to every detail of his plan. He is open to compromise. He's reached his hand out. Said he's open to new ideas, says he's willing to, you know, do all kinds of stuff. You know, we just need to get it done. And he said, look, at the end of the day, the Senate has passed a bill that would say 98% of the tax cuts, they continue on. The House, they haven't. So he's saying, look, at the end of it, we need to get that passed, and we should do that, the things that we agree on right from the beginning. So what did we hear from the Republicans? I mean, because what you've got is a president who's going, you know, my hand's out. I'm extending the olive branch. I'm extending my hand, trying to say, hey, you know, we got to work this out. You know, the problems that come by not doing this are great. Could harm the nation if we let this go too long. You know, hey, we need to do this. So what does Mitch McConnell say, Senate Minority Leader? He says one issue I've never conflicted about is taxes. He said, wasn't sent to Washington to raise anybody's taxes to pay for more wasteful spending. And this election doesn't change my principles, McConnell said. He said, this election was a disappointment without doubt, but let's be clear about something. The House is still run by Republicans, and the Republicans still maintain a robust minority in the Senate. He said, I know some people out here think Tuesday's results mean Republicans in Washington are now going to roll over and agree to the Democrat demands that we hike tax rates before the end of the year. He said, I'm here to tell them there is no truth to that notion whatsoever. So for all of the hopes, all of the thoughts, all of the possibilities that there was going to be some kumbaya moment and there was going to be bipartisanship, McConnell has told you, he's dug in. There is no movement. There is nothing going to happen right there. And you got to wonder, and I think about this often, you got to wonder what it is about that 2% of those tax handouts, the 2% of the people that the Republican Party represents, that keeps them so entrenched, that keeps them so dug in. And it comes back to Citizens United. It comes back down to the campaign cash. And what I've been saying for the longest time is Republicans better wake up and say, we've got to get this spending under control. We've got to get this campaign money under control because you know what? Live by the sword, die by the sword. As soon as they get out of line, you know what? That money's going to turn on them. It's corrosive. It's destructive to our democracy. And I'm telling you right now, we had better do something and quick. Because you look at this party right now, and while I like to believe that Boehner is a wheeler and a dealer and he wants to get something done because he doesn't want to be the center of attention and have to have these fights all the time, McConnell, I don't believe is. I believe he's a guy who scorched earth. So it's going to be interesting to see where the next several weeks take us. And as I've said, this isn't the end of the world if it doesn't happen by the end of the year. I think the longer it goes, the more people are going to get antsy and the more the Republicans are going to feel the heat. I truly believe that. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO political director Michael Podhorzer says it was working class rejection of Bush, Romney, Ryan economics that drove victories for President Obama and U.S. Senate candidates in Ohio and across the country. Podhorzer says that Labor's massive ground game also delivered by reaching working class voters with a focused message on economics, especially in battleground states. Households with at least one union member and working America households voted 66%. For Obama, Working America is a community affiliate of the AFL-CIO, active in several states. Its members are not union members. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler says that volunteer activists who make Labor's campaign ground game happen are very passionate, and they're motivated by a variety of individual reasons, but also share basic values and beliefs.
They all have unique reasons, really, for what drives their activism, but they also all have a common belief system and set of values that bring them to this campaign. And that is, of course, preserving the middle class, fighting for good jobs and investments in education and health care and making sure that we all play by the same rules. I mean, it actually makes you want to cry, the passion behind what drives these folks. So that's what cuts through the noise, right, of all these negative ads and what really has made a victory for working families across this country.
Westgate Resorts founder David Siegel made headlines in October after sending out a letter telling his employees likely need to cut back on staff if President Barack Obama won in his reelection bid. Instead, he gave them raises. On average, every Westgate employee will see an increase of 5% in their paycheck starting this week. Siegel told Bloomberg Businessweek that he made the decision so his employees can better, quote, handle the additional burdens the government will put on them, end quote. More labor unrest is gripping South Africa, Jesse Russell reports.
A farm owner has been arrested in the Western Cape of South Africa for attempted murder after firing on protesting farm workers. The workers have been protesting since October 30th, demanding higher wages. The workers allege that the government wasn't paying attention to their demands, so some farm workers set fire to a vineyard in protest. The workers earn on average the equivalent of $8 per day, and they argue that isn't enough to support a family and feed their children. They've dubbed the wage a hunger wage. They're demanding that commercial farmers growing grapes and citrus for export should pay the equivalent of $17 per day. The farming unrest in the Western Cape comes at the same time as South Africa is seeing labor unrest in other industries, most notably mining. Gold, coal, diamond, platinum, and iron mines have all seen workers put down tools and walk off the job, demanding better wages and working conditions.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Democrats in the Senate are terrified that in 2014, the next election, 20 Democrats are up for election, 10 of whom are in very Republican states. If they try and raise taxes, if they shut the government down because they're having a hissy fit that they insist on their little tax increase and that they'd rather shut the government down than not get their tax increase, the Democrats will get wiped out in the Senate in 2014.
Don't blame it on sunshine. Don't blame it on moonlight. Don't blame it on the good times. On a buggy.
Yeah, gonna have a hissy fit. Oh, yeah, if they don't get their little tax increase. And I love that, the way that he marginalizes that. I mean, it's beautiful. You got to give him credit, though. I mean, he is the spokesperson of the ultra-rich. He's one of the folks who has... I like the way David Stockman put it. You know, the Republicans have this tax cut fetish. And that's really what it is. It's this bizarre obsession that they keep, you know, again, it's the big lie. You keep saying enough, and well, somebody might believe it, and sadly some do. Yet study after study, fact after fact shows that the more we hand to the wealth class, the less it actually benefits us, actually harms the country. And you look at this last election cycle, this whole push towards privatizing Medicare. We need the vouchers. And, you know, Bush wanting to get rid of Social Security back a couple of years ago. This is really, really screwing this nation up. And the hissy fit is to save Social Security, save Medicare, save the social safety net in this country that, you know what, saved us from depression because of their ideology. Let's talk about Social Security and Medicare. I got Dana Bell, Policy Associate over at Social Security Works. Dana works on policy, research, and social media with Social Security Works. Dana, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me.
So I look at this phony crisis that's coming up, the debt cliff, the fiscal cliff, I'm sure you've heard.
Oh, of course.
And the way I look at this is, you know, they've created this really, really draconian outcome so that they could go after Medicare, so that they could gut Social Security and push it off and maybe even poison pill it as they've done in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's another excuse. Over the past couple of years, there have been a number of actions that the Republicans have and members of Congress who want to attack Social Security have tried to do that, to force action on it, when in fact the crisis is many years away. And, well, it's not even really a crisis, you know. There's the trust fund is going to be coming up short in 20 years or so. And so what we're hoping for is that they'll leave this out of any deficit negotiations, because it's not contributing to the deficit. And it's not part of the fiscal cliff.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the important part for people to remember. I don't understand why anyone's even considering putting that on the table when it's not even part of the problem.
Right, right. I mean, that's when you really see the ideology coming through, when Social Security is self-funded and doesn't contribute a dime to the deficit.
And, you know, I look at this, and you go, and I remember the Simpson Bowles thing and the whole, you know, we're going to come up with this grand bargain, we're going to do all this stuff. And what it really amounted to was, let's see how much we can extract from the working poor in this country. Let's see how much we can screw the working people and save the people at the very top. Because, you know, they're job creators. Did you know that, Dana?
I've heard. The
folks at the very top, creators. The folks that we're going to destroy our social safety net for, they're the job creators.
Putting it under a grand bargain makes it seem like there's shared sacrifice, when in all of these grand bargains, the sacrifice falls mainly on the working poor and on working class Americans who've already sacrificed so much in this recession.
Yeah, you know, you look at this, and almost immediately, and I got to be honest, I was concerned about where the president was going to go until I heard his speech today, because almost immediately you heard the grand bargain come up, or as I'm calling it, the grand betrayal. Because if they allow Social Security to be touched, if they allow Medicare to be even semi-privatized, that to me is a major betrayal.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think about the groups that helped Barack Obama get reelected this time and many members of Congress, it's working class people, it's Latinos, it's African Americans, it's union members, and to sell them out either by voucherizing Medicare, which is increasingly looking like it's off the table, or touching Social Security or cutting benefits in any way, that's betraying the people who've elected you to office to work on their behalf.
Yeah, I think the president said that. He said, look, you know, the American people reelected us and voted for us to protect their jobs, not ours. And I agree with
that.
It's time to actually get something done. And I look at the statements by McConnell, and I look at some of the statements by other Republicans who there doesn't seem to want to be any movement towards actually doing any work. I mean, I'm afraid that we're going to see two more years of gridlock, two more years of delay and obstruction and all the nonsense we've seen for the last two, instead of job creation, instead of solving the problems that we've got. And Social Security, to me, is the easiest fix of all.
Just
lift the cap.
Right. I mean, it seems like right now we have an opportunity to put pressure on Republicans and get things moving again and focus on job creation. And if we're looking at the deficits and looking at what our top earners can contribute, and not focus on Social Security as a problem, but really looking at it as part of the solution to the damages from the recession that many people are still feeling.
Yeah, I'm going to use the evil S word, the stimulus word.
Oh, yeah.
Going to use that word, because I believe if you were to remove the cap and lower the rate a little bit, you know, maybe that 2% that are already going into people's checks, make that permanent. I think it would be a good stimulus, maybe even a little bit more. And you would still solve the problem, I think, if you've got people who are making $1 billion a year paying the same tax rate that I'm paying on 100% of the income that I make.
Right. I mean, it's a fair trade to make, or even just raising it to 90% of income where it's traditionally been, and right now it's at 83% of taxable income falls under the cap. So raising it that much would be a huge help and would really be fair to everyone, because, I mean, if you pay more, then you will receive more in benefits. So it's not necessarily, you know, it's not a lose-lose situation.
But here's what gets me. I mean, here's what gets me. I mean, a lot of these seem like very common sense solutions. Why can't we seem to get this through the heads of the people who are sitting and giving these press conferences and sitting in the Hall of Congress? That there are very simple solutions out here. It means that we're going to have a fair and equitable way of funding these programs. It means the people with the bigger shoulders are going to carry a little bit more water, because you know what? They use a lot more of the services. They use a lot more of the infrastructure.
Yeah.
We should be asking, you know, a little help, you know, don't you think?
Yeah. Definitely. And in terms of Social Security, it seems like people are forgetting why it was created and what the American people did to build it, and that it's a wage insurance program that generations of Americans have contributed to, and it helps all types of people. It helps rich people. It helps poor people. And we want to make sure that it's strong enough for all of American citizens. And if that means that wealthier people need to start contributing at rates that they've historically been contributing, then I think that that's a very fair thing to ask.
Now, the other thing that I look at when I see this, I go, you know, one of the best ways we can fix all of our problems, Maybe start investing in the country and getting people back to work. You know, I don't know. I know some construction workers who need a job. They can pour concrete. We need some bridges built and some roads fixed. We've got high-speed rail I'd love to have across the country, broadband. We need cops and firefighters and teachers and all of them. Maybe if we started funding some of these programs, maybe we would have more money going into the system, more workers contributing. Because you know how many people have told me, well, you know, Rick, back when Social Security started, there were 16 workers for every person getting Social Security, and now there's two.
Right. Well, that number is a very misleading number, since it really evened out. But there have been two workers per beneficiary for a long time now. So that's nothing new. In 1950, when the program was still very, very young, there were, you know, what did they say, like 16 workers per beneficiary. But as the program extended and as workers became more productive, that ratio has shrunk a lot. But, you know, it can still be sustained at two workers per beneficiary. That's a very reasonable number.
So let me ask you this. You know, let me ask you this, as we look at the future, because, you know, I don't think a lot of people understand what a future without Social Security would look like, because I don't think we know our history. I don't think we know where we've come from. Let's say that we allow Social Security, the age to be moved up to 70, because I've heard that number thrown out a couple of times, and we lower the benefits and change the way it's calculated for cost of living increases, and we do all this stuff so that you slow the rate of the amount of money going into my grandmother's bank account, and when I go to retire, I'm going to have to do it years later. What's that going to look like for our economy?
I don't think it's going to look very good. I mean, raising retirement age falls disproportionately on lower-income workers who have more physically intensive jobs. So that is physically very difficult for a huge portion of Americans. And lowering benefits, I mean, the average benefit right now is around $15,000 a year. That's the average benefit. So we're not talking about a lot of money. So reducing that would put a lot of people into poverty who otherwise would not fall into poverty. And then on top of that, encouraging people to work longer is not necessarily better for the economy. As we see now, we want higher worker turnover. We want people to retire because it facilitates a smoother transition, not just for older people, but for younger people into jobs, for middle-aged people into higher positions of jobs. But we want to make sure that America has a secure retirement to better facilitate our economy, for people to be able to contribute to it even after they're retired. And a lot of these plans that people are floating right now, even if it's just changing the cost of living adjustment, would really damage the strength of that economy.
Yeah, and when you're talking about, you know, slowing the rate of growth, the money that goes in my grandmother's bank account, that means that she spends less in the economy, and you're basically slowing the economy down, more austerity, if you will, more constriction.
Absolutely. I mean, elderly people contribute to the economy as well, and, you know, we want to encourage them to. And, I mean, even we certainly don't want them to get back to where it was before the Depression, where people were turning to poorhouses and really...
Well, why not?
Why not?
I mean, you listen to Alan Simpson, who is the Republican, former Republican senator from Wyoming, who said, you know, we need to reform the system so it works like it used to. And then he went on to regale us with the tale that the Social Security age was 65 and people died in their 50s. That is a perfect conservative solution to our problem. You're dead 7 or 8 years before you can collect any benefits.
Right, of course. It's a totally misleading portrayal of why the Roosevelt administration set the age at 65. Because the idea that they would set it at 65 because people died at 65 would be a really messed up reason to set that as the age. In fact, people had fairly similar life expectancies back then. It was just the infant mortality rate was a lot lower. So the general life expectancy was 65. But once you reach 65, you're still living to about 70 or 71.
Yeah.
So you still have the same age. But, yeah, I don't know why he wants why he thinks that elderly people shouldn't have a secure retirement, but I'm hoping that he is less influential than I'm hearing he would be.
I'm hoping, because, you know, I look at what he said as well. He was asked about, you know, where's the money? And you go back to the Reagan year where they basically used the trust fund as a cookie jar for their Star Wars, the Cold War spending. And he basically said, yeah, it's gone. You know, we spent it. It's on bridges and stuff. Not to mention the two wars that have used a bunch of it, and not to mention it's mostly those worthless IOUs called Treasury bills.
That's what he said.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, saying that a Treasury bill is worthless, you're really selling out your government right there.
Well, don't you remember Bush running around the country in 2005 going, it's worthless IOUs?
Right. Oh, I mean, it's a common phrase for many people to use, but it's also misleading in that if the U.S. is defaulting on its Treasury bonds, we have a very big issue here.
Yeah,
so.
We've really gone off the fiscal cliff. So last line of questioning I've got for you, as we go down this path that they're leading us towards the cliff, and we're going to look over into the abyss because they've created this nice little crisis, you got to love the ticking bomb scenarios. What do we do? What's the messaging? How do we get folks to participate, and what should they be telling their representatives?
Well, I think we really want to stress that no cuts, and my organization, Social Security Works, has been working with MoveOn.org and Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, on a petition to encourage different people's representatives not to vote for any cuts to Social Security, and that includes raising the retirement age, that includes decreasing the cost of living adjustment. So that's at www.signon.org/no-cuts. And there are two main messages that we want to get across that we've sort of grifted from the AFL-CIO, which is raising the tax rate for high-income earners and no cuts, absolutely no cuts to Social Security and Medicare.
And we will make sure we get a link to the website there at thericksmithshow.com. Just click
great
on Dana's name. It'll take you right there, and we'll make sure that we get that out. Dana Bell, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for talking.
Great talking with
you. Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com. Today, I am notifying the honchos of Bain Capital, Blackstone Group, and other big-time private equity funds that my little company, Saddleburr Productions, can be had for a price. I published this notice in response to a recent news item revealing that these funds have a perplexing problem. They have too much money on hand. In all, they're holding $1 trillion that super-rich speculators have entrusted to them. Private equity funds are corporate predators that borrow from the rich and then buy out targeted corporations, dismantle them, and sell off the parts for a fat profit. However, in these iffy economic times, these flush funds have hesitated to do big takeovers, so they're sitting on all that cash, which they refer to as dry powder. Under the rules of this high-stakes casino game, however, firms have to spend their borrowed money by a set time or give it back. And the clock is ticking. So, using Wall Street's macho lingo, the big players have announced that they're ready to go elephant hunting and are prepared to fire big bucks to bag some companies. To which I say, fire away at Saddleburr Productions. Okay, my company is hardly an elephant, but
Maybe it could be what the equity hucksters refer to as a hot potato. That's when one firm grabs a company just to sell it to another firm, which might pass it off to yet another. They are expected to spend more than $22 billion this year selling hot potatoes to each other, in part just to move cash out the door so they don't have to give it back. This is Jim Hightower saying, believe it or not, this is what passes for good business sense in the truly screwy world of private equity. All they're doing is churning money, producing absolutely nothing, except, of course, huge fees for the churners. Think what good that $22 billion would do if it were put into the real economy. But if that's the game, hey, put me in the mix. $1 billion sounds about right.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Quote of the day, my favorite quote. I love this quote now. Jason Chaffetz, the Republican representative from the state of Utah, he said, quote, the president may have won a second term, but I won a third. What the hell does that mean? And will you give the president the potential to run for a third, huh, Jason? Insanity. Just nuts. I'm going to love this. Citibank got rid of their CEO, this Vikram Pandit, and also the chief operating officer, this John Havens. So they got rid of them. And I would make the argument that they were fired. But, you know, it was one of those, well, we parted ways. Turns out, according to Security and Exchange Commission filings, of course, today it came out, $15 million plus for each of them. More than $15 million each of them for being fired. I mean, I've never gotten a job where they've said, here's a check on your way out the door. And I love what the chairman said. And it's one of those, you know, go, wait a second, Mike, what are you talking about? Michael O'Neill, the chairman, said, Vikram and John made significant contributions to Citi during their 5 years of service. 5 years. So that means for being fired, they picked up a severance package over $3 million a year. It's been reported, O'Neill said directors decided that it was fair for the men to receive incentive pay for the progress made in 2012. What about 2008 and 2009? And, what about that? They said, while Citi will also honor all past awards that they are legally entitled to, there is no severance payments. Awards which are not legally entitled to have been forfeited. They got $15 million plus, each of them. Not to mention, they got their salaries when they left. Their contracts, remember? They'll also receive 40% of their 2012 payments immediately in cash. Immediately. And I wonder if they have to go in with a big box and count it out and put it into a big suitcase. But I look at this and I go back to, you know, the CEO class in this country, the wealth class in this country never loses. Because they write their contracts, they write their own rules, they're the entitled class, yet what we minions at the bottom, worker bees, we're told not to look up there. No, don't look up at the queens. No. The welfare queens among you. I'm sorry, I'm not getting it. Not getting it at all. And what's angering to me is I have so many friends going, oh, I saw somebody, they bought a pack of cigarettes with food stamps, which is nonsense. And I go, you know, hey, let's call and find out, because it's not happening. But yet, man, $15 plus million, because understand that, well, it's a private corporation, Rick. Yeah, but it's fees and it's money that you paid to the banks that you shouldn't have had to. Which is why, again, I go back to, take your money out of the banks. put them in the credit unions, or at least you have a little bit of say, some touch of say. But it brings me back to this whole thing of the contract. I mean, these guys got this kind of money. Why? Because they had contracts. They had something in writing that says, hey, when you fire me, and you will, you're going to have to pay me. And I look at Robert Nardelli, the guy who was the CEO of Home Depot. $210 million check he took out the door. $210 million for tanking their stock. Yeah, that's meritocracy. I love that, too. Oh, meritocracy, Rick. Dupes. Let's go to the phone line. It's got Ike on line one. How you doing today, Ike?
Hey, man. I don't know. I'm listening to the rhetoric coming from the Republicans, and, I can't put my finger on it, but there's a rat in the details. If they're after revenue, I don't see where there's obvious. It seems obvious to me that by saying that they'll close loopholes, that just means that they're going to leave these guys an out to where they might close a loophole or two here or there. But these big boys are going to be able to shift around it anyway.
No, here's the thing. And look, you go back to we've seen this movie. Look at 1986 when they passed the tax reform bill of 86 under Reagan. And they came up
right.
with this grand plan. We're going to lower that top marginal rate from 50% down to 28%, and we're going to close all these loopholes. And they did. They closed
right.
a whole bunch of loopholes. But you know what happened the next day? They started handing out big loopholes. So you lowered the rate, and the people with the money were able to go back and lobby and get their loopholes wide and even wider. And who got screwed? Well, you and me did because, well, they started taxing unemployment benefits. They took away any interest that you and I pay on credit cards or car payments, the interest we were able to deduct before, not anymore. What's going to happen now? They're going to go after home mortgage interest. They're going to go after the child tax credit. They're going to go after a lot of those things that you and I use, and we're never getting back. And for a short period of time, the billionaire class, they'll lose a loophole or two, but they're okay with that because they know they're going to get it back.
Wasn't at the same time they did that other thing about repatriating money from overseas?
Well, that was back. They've done that a couple of times, but it was back during the Bush years where they said, oh, lower the rate, repatriate the money. And we did. They brought all that money back, and guess what they did with it? They divvied it up amongst themselves. They bought back shares of their companies, pumped up the price of their stocks. CEOs made tons of money. And by the way, they actually laid off workers and fired more workers.
That's right. That's right. Now I remember. All right, so here's the question. I guess this is the trigger point. Do you think that is it conceivable that we go over the ledge and the Republicans have to eat it for the responsibility with the American public, or do you think the damage would be so severe that neither side can really afford to do that? Or how in the world are the Democrats going to fight it? That's what I mean.
I think the Democrats are in a better spot. Look, I mean, because they're fighting for 98%. They're saying, look, we want to pass those immediately. So what the Republicans are dug in on is they're dug in on, we're going to defend those 2%. And, you know,
right.
the rhetoric of, well, we don't want to raise taxes on anybody, it falls hollow with most people, especially that first paycheck. And I'll tell you, it'll be the first paycheck when people go, whoa, 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 I was expecting more and it's not there. That's when the anger starts. So the closer to that date, I think, and this is just my opinion purely, the closer to that date, I think the more heat Republicans get. From here till then, though, I think the Republicans are going to try and turn up the heat and turn up the rhetoric in the hopes that Dick Cheney's right, that Democrats cave because that's what they do. And my hope is that we don't see the grand betrayal. The hope is that Obama gets a steely spine because of what happened Tuesday. The hope is that they stay the course and say, look, we're gonna defend 98%, but you know what? We do have some deficit problems. We do have some budget problems, and we need more revenue. And that's just the bottom line of it.
And you know what? Since you just said that, that's exactly, now that I think about it, that's what I heard from Obama, where he made a quite clear division between the lower-end tax cuts and the higher-end tax cuts. He did say he was going to separate them, and that's his strategy. He'll go after the bottom end and let them vote it down and then let the American people jump on them.
And the nonsense that we keep hearing, and this is the rhetoric that the Republicans are going to use, that by having that single person over 200,000 and the couple over 50, oh, it's going to harm small business, which is ridiculous. Because I don't know, and I know a lot of small business owners, I know none of them that make over $200,000 in profit as a single person or $250,000 as a couple. I know no one who makes that kind of money.
Right.
It's not revenue. It's not how much business you do. It's how much profit you put into the pocket of the guy who owns. There are very few of those. Most of them are pass-throughs. Most of them are hedge fund managers. Most of them are big attorney firms. At the end of the day, most people aren't going to. 97%, I think, was the number I saw. 97% of small business will be unaffected.
Right, and that's also where the Republicans will be lined up against the wall as being the oligarch protectors and throwing the rest of us under the bus. And also, too, that gives the extra ammunition that's been provided by the CBO that tells the truth about job generation with tax cuts, and it's a myth.
Yep. And this whole tax cut, this whole tax cut fetish is just that.
I got it. Yeah, I thought I had it organized, but you put a fine point on it. I sure, you know, that's what I needed to get straight in my head.
I appreciate it. I always appreciate the call, Ike. Thanks so much.
Have a good weekend, buddy.
Yep. You know, you keep hearing about the small businesses, and when we come back, I want to talk about the small businesses are the job creators. Well, we're going to find out about it. Quick break. Stick around right after this. Corporations and billions of welfare. Well, millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Corporations and billions of welfare. Well, millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Multi-billions in this country and not a dime to spare.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Earth, sky.
When lightning strikes, it makes waves that can be seen from space. That's according to satellite researchers with NASA.
The researchers described it as a repeating atmospheric heartbeat of our planet. Flashes of earthly lightning leaking out into space, making these waves.
According to NASA, Earth has about 2,000 thunderstorms at any given moment. Together, these storms produce about 50 flashes of lightning every second. Each lightning burst creates electromagnetic waves that bounce off the atmosphere and encircle the Earth. Most of these waves are trapped inside Earth's ionosphere, a layer of the atmosphere about 60 miles or 100 kilometers up.
If the lightning waves have just the right wavelength, though, some of the waves combine in the atmosphere and increase in strength like ripples in a pond. Physicists call this the Schumann resonance, but they hadn't seen it until now. An instrument aboard a U.S. Air Force satellite detected these waves created by lightning flashes in Earth's atmosphere that had leaked out into space.
Scientists say this discovery opens up possibilities to study lightning, thunderstorms, and Earth's atmosphere from above. For more, visit earthsky.org and search for the words lightning waves. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every night. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, we keep hearing that the fiscal cliff, and if we go over, it's going to be the end. Oh, small business is going to be crushed. And you see all of these. There have been a number of small business owners who claim that they had to lay people off. We're not going to hire people. The guy from Applebee's, which I guess I can't go to Applebee's anymore. Some guy out in Vegas said, I had to lay off, a bunch of my Hispanic workers, 22 of the 114, he claimed, which I don't know how true that is. I'm hoping they actually hunt this person down and go, because I got to be honest. There's something seriously wrong with our labor law and what goes on in this country. If just on a whim, I lost an election. I lost a bet on a football game. You're all fired. Or like the Waffle House guy, allegedly, you won't have sex with me. You're fired. Here we go. But we keep hearing that, the fiscal cliff. It's the end. Oh, if that fiscal cliff happened, jobs gone. But you go back to the Clinton years when the tax rate was 39.6% at the top for the top marginal rate. What they actually found out, and the people from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities have graphed this out, that small businesses grew twice as fast during the Clinton years than they did when Bush was in office. Because those are your two different worldviews. A bit higher tax rate, a bit more spending on certain things, a little more investment, or, well, complete tax cuts and borrow, borrow, borrow. Because think about during the Clinton years, they took that money and actually paid down the debt. And I can't say enough, when Alan Greenspan was surprised, oh, I just don't know. I don't know what the country's going to look like once we pay off the debt. Do you remember 2000? I mean, I know it's a long time ago, but remember the year 2000 where we were looking to the future with wide eyes and great hope, because we were going to be debt-free. We were going to be that burden of the Reagan spending, that burden of the George H.W. Bush spending off our backs. And then what did we do? Well, we went backwards. The little shrub years came in and boom, an explosion of debt. And even before Obama said, I do, they ran up $1.6 trillion in the deficit that year. That didn't matter who president was in 2009. Didn't matter who the guy was. Would have been McCain. It had still been $1.6 trillion added to our debt because of the Bush policies. Didn't matter. And conservatives never talk about that, how bad their policies have been for this country and how bad they've been for small business, and which just blows my mind that you would have small business owners who would even think about voting for a Republican. Now you got Boner running around going, well, you know, that Ernst & Young study would kill 700,000 jobs. And it's been, you know, time and time again. It's a flawed study. It's been put down. It's been discredited. But you know what? Boehner needs to stick with it because it's all he's got. Because they need to scare people. It's going to kill 700,000 jobs. How many people remember during the minimum wage fight when we heard the same doomsday arguments? Oh, you know, if we raise the minimum wage, oh, you know, all these employers are going to lose. It's going to be the end. They're just going to stop employing people. They're going to close up shop and go away. And you know what the studies actually found? You can say it. You know. Employment actually increased. And why did it increase? Because what I've been saying on this program for years is what's reality. Demand drives investment. Demand creates jobs. When someone sees that there's a demand for something, there is going to be an entrepreneur who is going to fulfill that demand. Someone who's going to meet that demand one way or another because there's profit to be made. And you look at these tax handouts for the very wealthy. The CBO and the Congressional Research Service both have said, you know what, if they expire for the very top, it's gonna have virtually no effect on our economy. The Joint Committee on Taxation found that only 3% of small businesses would have any change in their tax structure if the top rates were to expire. I mean, you know, at some point you have to wake up to the reality of what fact is. And what sadly has happened because of conservative policy, because of pro-business, oh, we need to give more tax cuts to the wealthy because they're the job creators, or so we've heard, is we had the Grand Recession. We had the Bush Recession. And I look at this graph by Army Sufi. He's a professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He analyzed Federal Reserve data, and he said, you know what? Something very simple happened during the Great Recession. For poor and median income households, the Bush Recession wiped out 20 years worth of accumulated gains. Their net worth accumulation wiped out, gone, done. And as I've been saying, look, if we're going to follow the boom-bust cycle, if we're going to follow the boom-bust model, this is what happens. The people at the bottom and in the middle of the of the economic scale, they're the ones who are harmed the most. The wealth class, they're always going to do well. They can weather the storm. It's those people at the margin. It's those people like you and me who are working paycheck to paycheck close. You know, how many people do I know? I can't even tell you how many people I know who are 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks away from, you know, I lose my job and unemployment dries up. We're homeless. And I'm telling you, what bothers me is we have given these handful with the wealth that they have and the power that they have and allowed them to isolate themselves from the rest of the country, we've given them the ability to crash this economy. And you watch. If they don't get what they want, like a two-year-old throwing a tantrum, I don't believe that they have a problem watching this economy tank. Remember yesterday we talked about the guy, Robert Murray, the guy, the CEO of Murray Energy, and his grand prayer, you know, asking the Lord to help him make the decision to lay people off, you know, because it's going to be tough decisions, you know. It's going to be tough because Obama, he won. Evidently, they laid off a bunch of miners at the West Ridge Mine in Utah. According to Utah American Energy Incorporated, which is a subsidiary of Murray Energy, the layoffs, they said, were necessary because of the president's war on coal. Now, understand, coal employment is at a 15-year high. But, you know, the attack line has been, well, he's anti-coal. Understand, coal employment, 15-year high. But they have this because it's their talking point. You remember the dirty miners in front of Romney who were told, hey, you better come. It's mandatory. I actually had somebody told me that I was lying when I said it was mandatory. No, it was the statement said it's mandatory. It's mandatory, but we didn't force anybody to come. And I don't know what mandatory means in your world, but it means you better get your butt there. So they laid off these workers, and one of the workers who got laid off went to Reddit, and this is what he wrote. Despite the fact that nothing has changed in the 2 days since the election, they decided to lay off employees. He says, I've seen how corrupt the company can be over the years, and I'm fairly certain that the layoffs are just a way to make the president look bad. Do you think? I mean, they told you they were going to do it, and now they've done it. At some point, don't we have to look at the labor laws in this country? Because, sadly, in too many states like Pennsylvania, unless you have a labor contract, you're at will, which means you can be fired for no reason whatsoever. There's the door. I don't need you. There's the door. As long as they don't say, get your old behind or get your black behind or get whatever, any discriminatory statement that's federally covered, as long as they don't do anything dumb like that, you're out the door with no recourse. And here again, it's this whole, you know, I look at Murray saying, well, he's going to kill coal by 2030. And I go, you know, where'd you pull that number out of? Could it be you were looking at the projections of the natural gas drilling? Because nothing Obama is going to do is going to harm coal all that much, or as much as natural gas is going to. But, you know, you need a scapegoat. You need someone to blame. Interesting stuff. Again, if you missed any portion of the Rick Smith Show, download the podcast there at the website, thericksmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Going to take a quick break back with Hour 2. Stick around.
Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
I'm Doug.
Birmingham. AFL-CIO political director Michael Podhorzer says it was working-class rejection of Bush-Romney-Ryan economics that drove victories for President Obama and U.S. Senate candidates in Ohio and across the country. Podhorzer says that Labor's massive ground game also delivered by reaching working-class voters with a focused message on economics, especially in battleground states. Households with at least one union member and working America households voted 66%. For Obama, Working America is a key affiliate of the AFL-CIO, active in several states. Its members are not union members. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler says that volunteer activists who make Labor's campaign ground game happen are very passionate, and they're motivated by a variety of individual reasons, but also share basic values and beliefs.
They all have unique reasons, really, for what drives their activism, but they also all have a common belief system and set of values that bring them to this campaign, and that is, of course, preserving the middle class, fighting for good jobs and investments in education and health care, and making sure that we all play by the same rules. I mean, it actually makes you want to cry, the passion behind what drives these folks. So that's what cuts through the noise, right, of all these negative ads, and what really has made a victory for working families across this country.
Westgate Resorts founder David Siegel made headlines in October after sending out a letter telling his employees he'd likely need to cut back on staff if President Barack Obama won in his reelection bid. Instead, he gave them raises. On average, every Westgate employee will see an increase of 5% in their paycheck starting this week. Siegel told Bloomberg Businessweek that he made the decision so his employees can better, quote, handle the additional burdens the government will put on them, end quote. More labor unrest is gripping South Africa, Jesse Russell reports.
A farm owner has been arrested in the Western Cape of South Africa for attempted murder after firing on protesting farm workers. The workers have been protesting since October 30th, demanding higher wages. The workers allege that the government wasn't paying attention to their demands, so some farm workers set fire to a vineyard in protest. The workers earn on average the equivalent of $8 per day, and they argue that isn't enough to support a family and feed their children. They've dubbed the wage a hunger wage. They're demanding that commercial farmers growing grapes and citrus for export should pay the equivalent of $17 per day. The farming unrest in the Western Cape comes at the same time as South Africa is seeing labor unrest in other industries, most notably mining. Gold, coal, diamond, platinum, and iron mines have all seen workers put down tools and walk off the job, demanding better wages and work conditions.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant because they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hug a Republican today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. And, of course, if you missed any portion of the program, the podcast there at the website, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. So our governor is going to lead a trade mission to Brazil and Chile sometime in April. And guess what? It's going to be paid for with private sector money. Yeah, the people who are donating to his campaign, they're going to put him on. Think about vacation. Much like they did to Germany and France back in last March. He had a little six-day vacation. Well, they wined him and dined him, moved him around. Now, they claim this is a trade junket. You know, I kind of got to wonder. But here again, it's this idea we need to be more business-friendly. And to be honest, I don't know that I'm against so much, you know, our governor going and having, you know, some trade attempts. My problem is who's paying the bill and what allegiance comes with it? I mean, really, it's one of those things that makes me at least question what's going on. Because I look at what happened today, I just saw it today. The governor has decided. Now, look, remember what happened on Tuesday? Across the country, across this state, Democrats, you know, swept the statewide offices. the message was fairly clear. You know, we don't want business as usual. We don't want the same schemes you've been throwing out. Yet today, what does he do? They want to privatize the Pennsylvania Lottery. They want to enter into a private management agreement for the operations of the lottery. They want to enter into potentially a 30-year contract. And you go through and you go, explain to me what the purpose is, because, you know, this is one of those things that we do for ourselves. And the lottery money benefits senior citizens about $1 billion a year. And you look at what they said, what their one rationale that they wrote in their release said. They said that the levels of the lottery's annual returns have been determined largely by market forces. Yeah, when people have money in their pocket, they buy stuff. Demand. Remember the conversation about demand? They say this resulted in fluctuating and unpredictable levels of funding for senior programs, and it's the uncertainty of this demand that somehow they think that they're going to go to the private sector where people are going to want to make money, and somehow it's going to lessen that uncertainty. Now, what they said was the lottery profits for 2007 were $949 million. For 2011, it was $961 million. However, they said the three intervening years saw lower profit levels, and the low of $910 million was in fiscal year 2009. So 2007 was a good year. Uh-oh, 2008, 2009, 2010, not so good. There was something that happened during that time. What could it have been? I seem to remember, and maybe you do too, I seem to remember some kind of a recession brought on by idiotic conservative ideology. Do you think that would have had something to do with it? That even if we had this wonderful management agreement that they want to privatize our system with, that somehow it would make the system less unpredictable? Nonsense. They said a PMA, which is a private management agreement, would ensure such an increased level of future funding in the manner that it is secure and predictable. I thought we were talking about the free market. I thought we were talking about market forces, free enterprise. I didn't know that you wanted government interference in that. Just a thought. He says its objective would be to increase and optimize revenue and profit for the lottery above and beyond what could be realized by its continued operation by the Department of Revenue. That's the sentence in this whole thing that scares me. Its objective would be to increase and optimize revenue and profit for the lottery above and beyond what they're already doing. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean we're going to be putting lottery machines on every corner? Does it mean we're going to go out and start marketing to kids with cute little cartoon lottery scratch-off tickets? Is that what it means? I got to be honest. I see this and I go, well, where do they think they're going to find savings from? And not only savings, but profit for the for-profit corporation that they expect will give them $150 million so that they can have a little slush fund in case revenue doesn't meet. Where is that money going to come from? Let me think. Oh, yeah, the 258 Commonwealth employees who do the job now. If we could fire 186 of them, which is what they're proposing, then they can make a little money. And I look at this and I go, you know what? That's what it's about. In the end of this, it's all about how can we screw the workers? How can we screw the people at the bottom? It's no different than the wine and spirit shops where they say, well, you know, we're just do away with all those jobs and maybe some private sector people. No, we know what would happen. Do you remember what they told us about the wine and spirit shops? We're going to get billions of dollars. I think the original number was $2 billion. And then by the time, well, 1.7, 1.4, you know, 500 million, and you start going, wait a second, the wine and spirits shops bring in about $500 million in profit a year. That's stuff that we don't have to pay. Why would I want to hock it off for a one-year payment? It's dumb. But it's their ideology. I mean, just like, do you remember the state parks? They wanted to go after that. They wanted to go after, they've been privatizing education, and that's a failure. You name it. You name it. They want to hock it off because they do not believe in us. They don't. They only believe in the almighty dollar, the person who's putting bucks into their campaign. That's it. And for me, just days after the election, this to me is one of those moments where I get the feeling that, and I look at what's going on in Washington, and I got to be honest, I fully expect nothing to happen until the end of the year. I really do, because you've got Republicans who are dug in. They are not going to compromise. They are not going to give an inch. And this, what the governor's doing here, which, you know, at the ballot box, people are saying, you're leading us down the wrong path. This just tells me that we're going to see more of the same. And until we decide, we the voters decide that the people who have done this need to be held accountable, and we got 2 years, which is the reason this came out when it did. And there'll be more privatization schemes. You know it's coming. There's going to be more business friendly, more handouts for the businesses because, well, evidently that's how we create jobs. But I thought government doesn't create jobs. You're right. That theory doesn't. And I look at this pension thing, and we're going to take a break here in a minute and talk to Frank Dermody, the House Democratic leader. You look at the pension situation that's coming up, and it is coming up. Their ideology is going to cost us more in every way, shape, and form just because it's what they believe. You know what they propose, and I've talked about this before. We sat in on the hearings. They want to move the workers who have a meager defined benefit pension, which means when they retire for the rest of their lives, they'll get a small amount of money every year. Somewhere around 20, most people are going to be around 20,000. The average is 24. That takes into account the people at the higher end of the income scale. You know, your representatives and your senators and folks like that. But the people that they want to go after, they're the ones who are making $18,000-$19,000 a year in retirement. That money that stays in our local economy. They want to do away with that. They want to do what the private sector has done to the rest of us with these crummy defined contribution plans, with these 401ks. And they've even admitted it's not going to solve our problem. In fact, it's going to make it worse. It's going to cost more. It's going to provide less of a benefit. It's going to help our economy less. But they should do it because it's their ideology. It's what they believe. And that's my problem with believers, with people who, and I have so many folks that I talk to who say, well, I believe. You're never going to get me to change my mind because I believe. I don't know that there are very few things that I'm that dug in on. I want to see numbers. I want to see facts. I want to see all of the tangibles. I want to see all of the angles. I want to think about it all. There's part of me that wishes I could live in that black and white world. You know, my way or the highway. You know, kind of like a two-year-old. Kind of makes me wonder. But I'm telling you, as we move down this road, they're going to continue this nonsense. This is ridiculous. And again, will they be held to account? Or have they gerrymandered this state so much that we can't hold them accountable until the Republicans in this state and in this area decide no more? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk with Frank Dermody, House Democratic leader, about this just ridiculous. Quick break, right back after this.
And make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Today, I am notifying the honchos of Bain Capital, Blackstone Group, and other big-time private equity funds that my little company, Saddleburr Productions, can be had for a price. I published this notice in response to a recent news item revealing that these funds have a perplexing problem. They have too much money on hand. In all, they're holding $1 trillion that super-rich speculators have entrusted to them. Private equity funds are corporate predators that borrow from the rich and then buy out targeted corporations, dismantle them, and sell off the parts for a fat profit. However, in these iffy economic times, these flush funds have hesitated to do big takeovers, so they're sitting on all that cash, which they refer to as dry powder. Under the rules of this high-stakes casino game, however, firms have to spend their borrowed money by a set time or give it back, and the clock is ticking. So, using Wall Street's macho lingo, the big players have announced that they're ready to go elephant hunting and are prepared to fire big bucks to bag some companies. To which I say, fire away at Saddleburr Productions. Okay, my company is hardly an elephant, but maybe it could be what the equity hucksters refer to as a hot potato. That's when one firm grabs a company just to sell it to another firm, which might pass it off to yet another. They are expected to spend more than $22 billion this year selling hot potatoes to each other, in part just to move cash out the door so they don't have to give it back. This is Jim Hightower saying, believe it or not, this is what passes for good business sense in the truly screwy world of private equity. All they're doing is churning money, producing absolutely nothing, except, of course, huge fees for the churners. Think what good that $22 billion would do if it were put into the real economy. But if that's the game, hey, put me in the mix. $1 billion sounds about right.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
We need a budget that employs simple honesty for the common growth of our commonwealth. We must continue the journey that will turn the road to recovery into the path to prosperity.
I got to be honest with you. It's nice flowery language, isn't it? Nice rhetoric. You got to love it. But then you look at what has actually been done. It's austerity is what it is. We've taken from the very poor, the marginalized, kicked, 70,000 folks off the general assistance budget. Why? Well, more handouts. So you look what happened on Tuesday. Obama swept the state. Casey swept the state. Cain, McCord, DePasquale all swept the state. But somehow the Republicans kept control of the House and the Senate, as well as 13 of the 18 congressional districts. Gee, I wonder how that happened. I can tell you. Creative map manipulation. When you rig the game, it's a whole lot easier to win. But here's my problem. My problem is, you know, the electorate said no more failed conservative schemes, no to austerity, no to more of the same. But what are we going to get for the next 2 years? More failed conservative schemes, more austerity, more of the same privatization schemes. And it's going to cost you and me. We're going to hand to the handful, and, well, it's going to cost us a bunch. And you look what our governor here in Pennsylvania did today, another privatization scheme, this time going after the lottery system. We see this is up on the auction block. This is why I've asked House Democratic Leader Frank Dermody to come talk to us. Frank, thanks for taking time for me.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
So I'm looking at this. You know, I think Tuesday was a referendum. Stop with all the nonsense of the last 2 years. But here we are, just a couple days out, another bad privatization scheme.
Well, that's right. 2 days after the election, and it is a bad privatization. And as this administration has constantly done, they offer solutions in search of a problem. We have the best-run lottery in the country. It's had record profits this year. Its overhead lottery running in the country, and yet they want to sell it. They want to send it over to a for-profit corporation, which will have to make money, have a return for shareholders. That can only come from one place, benefits for our senior citizens. That's where it comes from.
Or wages from workers. I mean, it's a matter of screwing the workforce and screwing the people who are supposed to get the benefit so we can have handouts for the profiteers.
That's exactly right. I mean, the workers are the ones who will pay the price. They're the most efficient in the country. Why would you want to take this on? It's not to reward your friends. It's about campaign contributions.
Yeah.
It's not about good government. It's not about having an effective and efficient lottery. And it may be about the only way they can make money is expanding gambling. I mean, right now, the lottery could do keno if they chose to. And the way it's been done in other states when they've sold the lottery, in order to make money, in order to make a profit, they've got to expand gaming. So then they make the money off of, let's say, they implement the keno. Well, we can implement keno right now with our current employees, have all that money go back to programs for seniors instead of the profiteers.
Now, you know, I'm looking at their proposed private management agreement, what they've put out, and they said, you know, levels of the lottery's annual returns have been determined largely by market forces, resulting in fluctuating and unpredictable levels of funding for senior programs. Somehow, I think by privatizing this and profitizing it, it's going to make that funding level certain. How's that supposed to work?
No idea. It doesn't make sense. And
aren't these the people who tell us that they believe in the free market and the market forces are, how are they going to usurp the free market?
Well, they can't. And you know what? It just simply isn't true. Our programs have been well funded. The lottery has never been in better shape than it has been today. And it's all been done with the state employees who have done a tremendous job, low overhead, making it effective and making it work for our seniors. Now, once again, they want to punish those who can least afford it.
And I look at this and I keep going back, you know, how is this supposed to work? How are you going to get private investors to come in and say, yeah, we want to run your lottery system if there's not a huge payoff? And the only thing I can come up with is, well, more schemes to get people, you know, gambling more. Are we going to go after children next? I mean, hey, they've got disposable income. You can put one of those vending machines next to the soda machine they want in the schools.
The only way that they can make profits, and what they've done in other states, is they've expanded gambling. Now, if that's the case, that's the issue, we'll talk about that. And if we're going to do it, I'll have the existing lottery system do it so that if there is extra money, they're going to have to do it, and those extra monies will go to senior programs. But the only way it can be done is, like I said before, I think Keno is, like, I know one of the things they could implement right now based on the law and the rules and the regulations. Mike, and what they've done in other states, where that's the case, that's what they've done. But they're going to let them expand gambling for profit for the corporation, not for programs for seniors. So if they want to talk about it, they ought to be upfront about whether or not they're talking about expanding gambling. Because you look at scratch the surface here, the only way that they can get the profits they need to, why else would a for-profit corporation come in here? They have to have a return on their investment.
Yep. The only thing I can tell you, Representative, is I look at this and, you know, it's not about the money. I don't really believe they care about seniors. I don't. I think it's all about the ideology of that there's nothing that we the people can do for ourselves. There's nothing that the state should be doing. Everything should be done for a profit and all the other stuff be damned. And all of the rhetoric and all the talk, the bottom line ideology is they do not believe that anything should be done by we the people.
Well, that's the ideology. That's how they feel. The government is all bad. You know, and it simply isn't true. And this is a case where we run important programs for, you know, prescription drugs and help folks get back and forth to healthcare appointments. We help people get around and survive, go to the grocery store, do the basic necessities for life. And yet they want to put this in the hands of a profiteer and jeopardize that. This should be a state program. It was well run, and so that the people understand that there's some responsibility, there's some oversight. We don't leave it up to the profiteers, because what they will do is, if making money or helping a senior, they're going to have to make money. They have an obligation to shareholders. Their legal obligation is to shareholders, not to senior citizens.
Now, here again, this strikes to me as the same argument they made for the wine and spirit shops. You know, oh, we're going to get billions of dollars, and it's going to fill all of our wildest dreams, and, oh, we're not going to have to cut education. And then when you get down to brass tacks, they're telling you, I'm sorry, we're actually going to lose money on this.
Well, yeah, sure. The amount of money other states that have tried to looked at privatizing, Virginia most recently, they're going to put it up for auction. The offers were so low that they pulled it off. They decided not even to move forward with it. They overestimate by the hundreds of millions of dollars as to how much money they will receive or derive from the sale of the stores. Meanwhile, you 5,000 people are out of work. These are people who have health care benefits. And they're all being paid for people who user fees. People who go into the liquor stores and buy wine and spirits, they're paying for it. Taxpayers, it doesn't come out of the tax funds. They contribute hundreds of millions of dollars a year to our general fund.
But here again, going back to the Representative Dermody, I mean, whether it's the lottery, whether it's the wine and spirit shop, there was talk for a while of our state parks being privatized. They're moving full bore on privatizing education. I'm sure the turnpike will pop up again at some point. It's their ideology. It's their blind faith. Yet no one can show me where these privatization schemes have benefited people like me and folks like my listeners.
Well, they don't. And particularly education is really scary to talk about privatizing education, because where they've done that, they've brought in for-profit corporations trying to run the Chester School District. It was a disaster. There have been for-profit charter schools. Most have not succeeded. It's certainly a mixed bag. I mean, we have a constitutional obligation to provide thorough and efficient education for our children. That's the government's responsibility, and we ought to take it seriously and fulfill it, but not try to sell it to the for-profit corporations whose obligation is not to children. Shareholder.
Here's what makes me angry, though. We're just a couple of days out of the election. I think the message was clear in this state anyway. What the last 2 years has brought us has to stop. What we should be doing is pursuing ways to create jobs, get people back to work, invest in our state, invest in our infrastructure. Yet I see this and I go, this is just more diversion, just this more more nonsense. When are we going to get to the actual work of, hey, we got some roads and bridges that need to be fixed?
There's another smokescreen to divert attention from the real problems that they don't want to face. The governor won't face. He won't take on the infrastructure issue. That is a jobs program. It's a public safety issue. I mean, right now, we need to take care of our roads and bridges and transit. And if you want to talk about jobs and economic development, if you want corporations to stay here, grow here, and come here, you have to have a transportation system that works. You have to have a transportation system that people want to ride. They want a transit system they can use that works for their region. And that's not happening today. And it's going to cause huge problems. And it's happening now. People, when you have incubators, which we have in both parts of the state and our metropolitan areas with our great universities, they start small businesses. They get to 100, 150 employees, and they make decisions about where they're going to grow. It's based on quality of life issues, and transportation is a huge issue with them. And they'll go to regions of the country that have developed light rail systems, that have been responsible in maintaining their transit system. And we have not done that, and this governor's got to face that. We're willing to work with him to do it, but I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel on that issue, and it is a safety issue.
Yeah, and one of the other things, reasons people locate to an area for business is education. I mean, and you look what this governor has done to education over the last 2 years is unconscionable. Cutting $1 billion from K-12 each of the last 2 years to me is absolutely unconscionable while pursuing this divide-and-conquer privatization scheme.
He cut the K-12, and we've seen the results. Under Ed Rendell, under Governor Rendell, test scores went up every single year. Our children were making tremendous progress. Those test scores are now going down. 17,000 teachers and staff have been laid off. Class sizes have increased. Activity fees have been implemented, and property taxes have gone up. And yet there he is trying to sell schools. He's trying to privatize it and ignoring the system that exists where most of our children will go to school. And we might have, and you're right. If people are going to locate here, they look at the public school system and whether or not they can send their children there. And right now we've got real questions as to whether this governor's committed to doing anything for education. And then we have higher ed, where he's cut 30-40%.
Yep.
I mean, right now you've got universities like Penn State, Pitt, Temple, looking at the possibilities of going private because diversely the state subsidies have been reduced so much that they may think about it.
And what's happened is that's fallen onto the backs of the working people of this state who want to send their kids to college and give them an opportunity at a better future. A guy told me not too long ago that back in the 80s, the state picked up about 2/3 of the cost of higher ed. The student's tuition was about 1/3. Today, that number is 75% of the cost bore by the students. Something is fundamentally wrong with how we're screwing the next generation.
And it does come down. The working families and middle-class families trying to educate their children who are feeling the impact of these cuts. They're the ones who are suffering, and those are the kids we ought to be encouraging. We ought to be helping them move up. We ought to help them get the education they need to move forward. And right now we're not doing that. And you know what? The sad part is that we've had resources there, that we've had revenues there that we could have used to do that. We've given away corporate tax cuts that make no sense, that could have been either frozen for a period of time. The depreciation tax cut where they said it was going to be only $200 million the first year. It was $400 million. Those monies could have been put towards education through K-12 and help. We did not have to suffer the way we have. And it's unconscionable. And that's why the House Democrats are going to continue to fight as best we can with our numbers with 92 so far to make sure that doesn't happen. And then make sure in 2 years from now that this record is on the line when it comes time to elect the governor.
Yeah, absolutely. And what bothers me, we still have the Delaware tax haven still wide open, where we're seeing lots of money that we could be using for education being just funneled out of the state. You know what bothers me, though, is we keep seeing this job-killing austerity, and you pointed out the 17,000 teachers?
17,000, yeah.
Just gone. That hurts our economy, and you look at bringing it back to this privatization scheme that they've got for our lottery system. 186 people are going to be fired. They're going to lose their jobs, and it's right in their proposal, 186 out the door. That means 186 decent jobs that supported a family that had some measure of benefits, some measure of health and retirement security, gone, eviscerated.
And it seems that they don't even care. Like, they're happy about that. They feel better about themselves when that happens. And it's totally unnecessary, and it is not more efficient. It's not more effective. It doesn't help the taxpayers. It helps some corporation. And, it's one thing, we're implementing efficiencies. They're not. We have the most efficient operation in the country. You have 86 employees that are doing their job every day, that are working effectively and efficiently, and they ought not to be just fired and thrown out. I mean, and you're right. It's an attitude that with these teachers and these state workers, they don't contribute to the community. That they don't pay mortgages and go to the grocery store. You know, they don't have children they have to take care of and educate. This makes no sense. It is just totally unnecessary, and there is no financial reason. There's no reason to help the government financially at all to do this, and it will have an impact on senior programs, a negative impact on.
But here's the thing, and this is the last line of questioning I've got for you, because, I sat in on one of the pension hearings with Daryl Metcalf, who it was painfully apparent to me that he believes that government should be the leader in the race to the bottom, that they should be the who are not making better working conditions and having better standard of livings for workers and better services for people, but should be the ones leading the race to the bottom. And I look at this pension issue that is going to come up. To me, what they've proposed, this move from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, that even their own experts say is going to cost we, the taxpayers, considerably more money than just fixing the original problem.
That's correct. It could cost billions of dollars more.
But here they are saying, well, it's our ideology. It would be better if we just did away with it. It doesn't matter what it costs, because this is what we believe. And my problem with folks on the right is they seem to be believers over the rest of us who live in the fact-based world where numbers and math actually matter.
I mean, I don't understand why people would want to deprive people of a little dignity when they retire. And what's going on here is we passed the bill 2 years ago, smoothing provisions to help this pension system, the impact of the recession lessened somewhat. And if we take a step back, let those laws have their impact. They will be very effective in reducing the pension problem that we have. And then, as you said, step back and then do make some changes and we have to make some payments into the pension plan. Because the employees have always paid in.
Yep.
It was the government when the funds were earning so much that stopped paying in. And we fixed those problems. You can have a defined benefit plan that works, and it works well.
Yep.
And if we go to something else, it will cost billions of dollars to the taxpayers for an ideology that makes no sense and would deprive thousands of workers of a decent retirement. What is wrong with that?
And not to mention, because a lot of people don't care about those workers, understand that that's money being pulled out of the Pennsylvania economy, because those workers, they stay here.
Well over 90% of that money is all spent in Pennsylvania.
And that would hurt that austerity, because it's what it is, would hurt our economy, and it would cost us jobs. But, they don't want to talk about that, because it's, again, blind faith belief. Frank Dermody, I appreciate the time. It's been great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Great speaking with you, too. Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Back after this, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Get up and take the fight. All they want to
Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class where to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
When lightning strikes, it makes waves that can be seen from space. That's according to satellite researchers with NASA.
The researchers described it as a repeating atmospheric heartbeat of our planet, flashes of earthly lightning leaking out into space and making these waves.
According to NASA, Earth has about 2,000 thunderstorms at any given moment. Together, these storms produce about 50 flashes of lightning every second. Each lightning burst creates electromagnetic waves that bounce off the atmosphere and encircle the Earth. Most of these waves are trapped inside Earth's ionosphere, a layer of the atmosphere about 60 miles or 100 kilometers up.
If the lightning waves have just the right wavelength, though, some of the waves combine in the atmosphere and increase in strength like ripples in a pond. Physicists call this the Schumann resonance, but they hadn't seen it until now. An instrument aboard a U.S. Air Force satellite detected these waves created by lightning flashes in Earth's atmosphere that had leaked out into space.
Scientists say this discovery opens up possibilities to study lightning, thunderstorms, and Earth's atmosphere from above. For more, visit earthsky.org and search for the words lightning waves. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
And I still believe we think that. I really do. But, you know, I look at where this Republican Party has gone, man, off the cliff. And even though they did take some beatings in key races across the country, still they have gerrymandered, they have jerry-rigged, they have done everything they can possibly do to secure their power, something that we're going to have to be fighting back against for at least another decade. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, one of the things that bothers me is here in the state of Pennsylvania, you got Tom Corbett as the governor, one of the people who signed on to the lawsuit against the Obamacare, the health care law, which deadline, November 16th, got to decide whether you're going to do it, we're going to start setting up the exchanges or not. And you look at the other day, Boehner was on with Diane Sawyer. And what he said was, look, you know, hey, it's law of the land. Obamacare is the law of the land. And immediately his office started tap dancing, trying to say, whoa, but we're committed to repealing it. Which to me says, well, we're committed to poison pilling it. Which has always been my fear with this setup. Is that they're going to poison pill it. But states have until the 16th, which is just, you know, a couple of days away, a week away, to say whether they're going to set up a private insurance market, the exchanges, whether they're going to do it here on the state level or if they're going to give control over the federal government. Personally, in states like this where the Republicans have control, I'm kind of opting, please, federal, somebody else set it up, because I see nothing good coming out of the governor's mansion. I see nothing good coming out of our General Assembly. They also have the option to enter into some federal-state partnership, if you will. And what these exchanges are supposed to do, as we've talked about at length, it's supposed to make it easier, a little more transparent for people, small businesses, individuals who don't have health care, to be able to go into this marketplace and to be able to shop for coverage. And it's also going to have some subsidies for folks who can't afford it. So the idea is, you know, the party that tells you they believe in personal responsibility, it's going to say, well, you know what? We're going to help you be responsible. And based on what you can pay, it's what you're going to do. Right now, as we speak, only 13 states and Washington, D.C. have officially said that they're going to set up the exchanges. And in states like Pennsylvania, where you've got Republican governors, about a dozen of them have said that, you know, well, we're not going to say anything. Because they're hoping that the Supreme Court, they hoped the Supreme Court would have overturned it, which didn't. And they really hoped Romney was going to win, and they bought into the, for day one, we're going to repeal. That didn't happen. Now, many of these Republican states are expected to, you know, to set up some type of an exchange. But, you know, some of them are going to go federal. Here's what bothers me. A lot of these states have done nothing, and they're not going to have time. So what happens is it's delay, it's gridlock. And the other part that's kind of worrisome to me is you've got the Boehners, you've got the Republicans, you've got the Daryl Metcalfs here in Pennsylvania who are going to figure out ways to try and screw it up. And that's what's really frustrating to me. I mean, because I've looked at what's going on with Medicare over the last several years especially. And you look at when they tried to poison pill it with Part D, and they set up the Medicare Advantage, the privatized, profitized version of Medicare. It wasn't to make it better. It wasn't to make it stronger. It was to destroy it. And that's one of the fears that I have with this exchange system. Because, look, I know a lot of people who are they're hoping that they can hold on till 2014. I think of one friend who, you know, like me, over the summer I had the gallbladder problem where I was in the hospital, in and out of the hospital a couple of times. And had it not been for insurance, man, I'd have been in a bad way. Because, you know, what is now a gallbladder surgery is pretty routine, pretty simple. I was in and out of the hospital in less than 4 hours. But it was the three bouts of pancreatitis because of the gallbladder that landed me in the hospital for 4 days apiece, three times. You know, that's expensive. And I think about my friend who's struggling with this. Because, you know, I got to hold off. I can't have it done. I can't afford it. I'll lose everything. I'll be bankrupt. We'll be in the street. Is that what we want in this country? Is pay or die what we believe in? And I don't think so. And, you know, what I've been talking about with Medicare, I mean, what we should be doing with Medicare is pretty simple. And it's what I wanted to do from the beginning, which they would have done. Just open it up. Do this with Medicare. Make Medicare the option. Say, okay, we got an exchange. We're going to set up an exchange, and Medicare is one of the options. And compete. You know, we have honest competition, which is why, you know, to me, the barest of minimum should have been a public option. But what we've done, and I love this rhetoric that the right keeps throwing, it's socialized medicine. It is not. It's not even close to it. Oh, he's a socialist. He's communist. He's not. These are privatized plans. I don't get an option to buy Medicare. I don't get a public option, which I think most people, when you realize how much overhead, how much profit, how much money goes into these insurance companies' pockets, you'd go, well, I think I want the public option. I want the Medicare option. I want the option where I have some say. And I know the right's just losing their mind about this, the death panels, the independent review panels, which, let me let you in on a little secret, if I could. It's modeled after the free market. It's modeled after what the private insurers already do. Because if you don't think there's rationing of care, you don't think there's denial of care, you don't know anybody who's been sick. You don't know anybody who's had to sweat out going, will this procedure be covered by my insurance or I'm going to lose everything? And good luck, you know, protesting at your local for-profit insurance company. You want to see yourself get locked up mighty quick? Which is why I'm all in favor of this going forward. Now, there are things that we should be doing, things we will be doing to make it better, to make it stronger, like we did with Medicare. And I look at Medicare as the blueprint. Because once people take ownership of it, which is why I wanted this to start sooner, why I didn't want folks to have to wait till 2014, Once people have something and they take ownership of it, and this is what's scaring the hell out of the Republicans. Because once people start benefiting from it, they realize, hey, this is actually working. And, oh, by the way, government actually can do something. Unlike what we've been told for 30 years, that government's not the solution, it's a problem. You know, we, the people, the problem. The rabble, the unwashed masses, if you will. See, I think the solution is do what we've done in the past. Now, we're not going to undo the for-profit system. It's not going to happen because the money powers are too great. But you go back and you think about it. I was talking to my grandmother. You know, when she had my mother and my aunt and uncle, it was like $50. I mean, the hospital bill was like $50. When my kids were born, I think about when my son Alex was born, who actually almost fell out in the parking lot. I mean, he was on the way. If it had been five more minutes, we'd have been dragging him behind my wife, going to the hospital room. That's $7,000 for no one having to do anything. Nature, it just went. I mean, he was coming no matter what. Nothing was stopping him. He wanted to see the light of night. $7,000 for no complications, nothing whatsoever, no medication, nothing. Didn't have time for an epidural, didn't have time for any drugs, nothing. It was coming over in minutes, $7,000. What's the difference between when my grandmother had her children and now? Well, we've got investors to pay. We've got Wall Street to pay. We got profiteers to make happy. Problem. And that's always going to be the problem until we get that under control. Let's take a quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. If you own a small business like me, you don't have time to spend doing all the paperwork, bookkeeping, and tax reporting. If you're like me, you want to focus all of your energy and attention on growing your business and succeeding. The paperwork's got to get done. The taxes have to be paid. Bob Miller, CPA, can help. Bob Miller and his experienced staff can handle all of your business's record keeping and tax preparation needs. Thanks to Bob Miller, CPA, and the year-round attention of his staff, I don't worry about surprises when the tax reports are due. Bob and his staff can help you too. They can accurately and professionally manage your business's accounts or your personal finances to ensure that you have access to all of the tax savings opportunities available to you. Call Bob Miller's team today at 717-737-7617 or check him out on the web at www.bobmillercpa.com. That's bobmillercpa.com. And take the worry out of tax time.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge.
At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, you remember back when, last year sometime, when Tom Corbett decided, hey, you know what, we're going to change how we allocate the electoral college, how we're going to allocate the electors. We're going to say, well, you know, we had 20 electoral votes, you know, we're going to allocate 13 of those to Mitt Romney. And, you know, you look at what's going on, or actually 13 of the 18. And you look at, and you remember the pushback? Because we saw it for what it was. It was an attempt to steal the election, to change the rules midstream. Well, it looks like Ohio, John Husted, the Secretary of State there in Ohio, is, well, kind of considering the same thing. There's talk right now of changing the winner-take-all system and, you know, moving to a congressional district system. Now, understand why they want this. They have gerrymandered a good number of these Republican states. Look at here in Pennsylvania how much they have rigged the game. Which, you know, I go back to when the Supreme Court here in the state looked at the gerrymandered state House and state Senate districts and threw them out as unconstitutional. They should have done the exact same thing with the congressional districts. And you look at some of them, you go, how do you come up with that? How do you do that creative mapping? Well, the push over the next couple of months, and I think the next year, in order to steal the election, is to go to this by congressional district. And why? If you would have looked at, if they would have had this in place right now, if the Corbett plan would have gone forward, and they could have done it in a couple other states like Florida or Michigan, Ohio, Virginia, Wisconsin. They could have done it in those states. Just, you know, set up the way, you know, in congressional districts where we've done a nice job of gerrymandering. Romney wins. I mean, you look at Florida. Of the 17 electoral votes, Romney would have gotten 17 electoral votes. In Michigan, he would have gotten 9. In Ohio, he'd have gotten 12. In Pennsylvania, he'd have gotten 13, Virginia 8, Wisconsin 5. That would have been 64 electoral votes. And guess what? Add those to the 206 that he has, and Romney wins. And you don't think they knew this before? The trial balloon was tested here in Pennsylvania to see how we would react. And we reacted correctly. Question is when they throw that trial balloon out again in Ohio or Florida or Michigan, how are they going to react? And for me, you know, the reality is you know, there are some who say we should have the popular vote, and I'm with you. Some say we should have a third party. You know, Herman Cain came out and said we had a third party. I'm not against it, but in order to have a viable third party, you need to have instant runoff voting. You need to give voters an option because you can't have a delegitimized president the day he wins office. You can't have a 34% president. It's not going to happen. But no one's talking about that. But what's amazing to me I look at this election cycle and I go, you know what? All of the things that happened in 2000, all the things that happened in 2004 happened again. The long lines, the fiddling with you know, secretaries of state in Ohio and other places here in Pennsylvania, fiddling with voter registration. You know, how do we make sure that more people have an opportunity to vote, that we expand the right? How do we come up with some kind of, an empowerment act, if you will? Well, I mean, one of the things we should be doing is modernizing how we register to vote. Not having it on 80-weight paper like they wanted to in Ohio back in 2004. Make sure that the equipment that we have is adequate for the number of people. This way you have shorter lines, and it's well equipped, and it's well taken care of. Expand early voting. But nobody wants to talk about that. What we keep hearing from the right is, how can we suppress? How can we hold down? How can we tap all of this down? Because, and the other part of me goes, well, it doesn't really matter. Because are they going to listen to the electorate anyway? And I look at, you know, this election on Tuesday, and look what our governor did. Comes out on Friday and says, well, never mind the election. We're going to do more privatization. You look at Ohio, where the Republicans took a thumping on the statewide elections. Like they did in Pennsylvania. What do they do in Ohio? Evidently, they're going to be going back to the anti-abortion stuff. Evidently, next week they're going to bring up for consideration House Bill 125, the heartbeat bill, they call it. And let's not forget, they're going to go after and try and defund Planned Parenthood again. And you go, at what point do they not get it? It's about jobs. It's about the economy. Yet again, all we keep seeing is divisiveness. All we keep saying is, it's like they're tone deaf. And the only way that they're going to get the hint is when they're on the outside looking in, which, folks, you know, I understand team sport mentality. I do. I understand. I'm a Republican. They may suck, but, you know, the other people are bad or worse. Your party's screwed up. You really, really need to fix it. Come back to some measure of sanity. And I know that they're looking now at, you know, why they had the losses, what the extent of what's going to do to the party. I know that. And I know that they're now maybe having a coming to Jesus moment on immigration. I've seen some people saying, well, you know, maybe we're going to think about doing something different. Because they got hammered by the Hispanic vote. Obama won 71% of the Hispanic vote. Romney got 27%. That's a greater gap than he even had with McCain. And you've got people saying, well, you know, maybe we need to start thinking about doing something. Do you think? But there's part of me that goes, I think the Republicans have dug so deep in on this that there's nowhere for them to go. And until they implode, I don't think there's anywhere for them to go after this. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about, the news and talk more about the Grand Cliff and the Big Bargain. Back after this.
Gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFL-CIO political director Michael Podhorzer says it was working class rejection of Bush, Romney, Ryan economics that drove victories for President Obama and U.S. Senate candidates in Ohio and across the country. Podhorzer says that Labor's massive ground game also delivered by reaching working class voters with a focused message on economics, especially in battleground states. Households with at least one union member and working America households voted 66%. For Obama, Working America is a community affiliate of the AFL-CIO, active in several states. Its members are not union members. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler says that volunteer activists who make Labor's campaign ground game happen are very passionate, and they're motivated by a variety of individual reasons, but also share basic values and beliefs.
They all have unique reasons, really, for what drives their activism, but they also all have a common belief system and set of values that bring them to this campaign. And that is, of course, preserving the middle class, fighting for good jobs and investments in education and health care, and making sure that we all play by the same rules. I mean, it actually makes you want to cry, the passion behind what drives these folks. So that's what cuts through the noise, right, of all these negative ads, and what really has made a victory for working families across this country.
Westgate Resorts founder David Siegel made headlines in October after sending out a letter telling his employees he'd likely need to cut back on staff if President Barack Obama won in his reelection bid. Instead, he gave them raises. On average, every Westgate employee will see an increase of 5% in their paycheck starting this week. Siegel told Bloomberg Businessweek that he made the decision so his employees can better, quote, handle the additional burdens the government will put on them, end quote. More labor unrest is gripping South Africa. Jesse Russell reports.
A farm owner has been arrested in the Western Cape of South Africa for attempted murder after firing on protesting farm workers. The workers have been protesting since October 30th, demanding higher wages. The workers allege that the government wasn't paying attention to their demands, so some farm workers set fire to a vineyard in protest. The workers earn on average the equivalent of $8 per day, and they argue that isn't enough to support a family and feed their children. They've dubbed the wage a hunger wage. They're demanding that commercial farmers growing grapes and citrus for export should pay the equivalent of $17 per day. The farming unrest in the Western Cape comes at the same time as South Africa is seeing labor unrest in other industries, most notably mining. Gold, coal, diamond, platinum, and iron mines have all seen workers put down tools and walk off the job, demanding better wages and working conditions.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, yes, the sky is falling. Tax-mageddon, the fiscal cliff, the end of the world. Oh, my gosh, there's a crisis coming. Have you been following the news? Have you heard that? Because that's all I keep hearing, the end of the world, the fiscal cliff, and, oh, we've got to extend it. And what's amazing to me is even though the Republicans took a thumping on Tuesday, they're sticking pretty much to the hard line. And good for them. You know, good for them. Might as well make themselves completely irrelevant. But here to talk about the president's speech today and his position and where we're going to go with the grand bargain, I guess, is coming back up. I've got Liz Rose, communications director at the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Liz, did you hear the fiscal cliff?
I did. I heard about the fiscal cliff, and I also heard the president today. And, you know, everybody who's actually paying attention to this stuff knows there's not going to be a sequester, there's not going to be cuts, but our fear has been that the president was going to, you know, make this grand bargain. It sounded like, from what he said today, there's all kinds of good news. He's going to listen to the people and really push hard to raise taxes on the wealthy, which is fabulous because that's what everybody wants. So we're really excited about that. And it sounds like the president is going to draw a line in the sand on no cuts, no cuts to Medicare, no cuts to Social Security, no cuts to Medicaid. And that's really what we're fighting for. I mean, it would be a really stupid time to cut the budget because that would actually hurt the economy. It would hurt all of us.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a whole model. We've got a whole all of Europe to look at to see, does austerity work? Does cutting public spending work? Well, no, it doesn't. It makes things much worse.
Yeah, because it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you lay off cops and teachers and firefighters, they can't, you know, go to donut shops and go to grocery stores, and then you
wow.
got to lay off donut store workers and grocery store workers.
Going right there, are you, with making the stereotype of the cops, huh?
Well, come on. They do eat donuts. It's an actual fact.
Well, I want to see the documentation, although I do know. Actually, my uncle, who is a retired cop, you're going to love this, he owns 3 donut shops.
I myself am pro-donut.
I'm okay? pro-donut as well.
Yeah, don't tell Mayor Bloomberg.
He may tax you on it.
He may.
And here again, I've got to be honest with you, Liz. I'm not against taxing sugary stuff that's going to cost us more. I'm not against it. I'm still going to consume it.
Right, exactly.
Same thing with
you
soda.
And I could solve the deficit just between the two of us and our donuts.
There you go. But here's the thing, and I think the president was right. On Tuesday, as he said, we found out that the majority of Americans agree with his approach. That, you know, the austerity, the huge tax cuts for the wealthy, more handouts to the top in the hopes that maybe, possibly, somebody might create a job. I mean, we've tried that. I mean, we've seen this movie over and over and again, and, well, it never ends well for us.
The beautiful thing is that the election seemed to remind the president that he should be on the side of the people and not be on the side of the CEOs, that Wall Street is not Main Street. I mean, I think that, you know, it seems like with new senators like Elizabeth Warren and old senators like John Tester, I mean, everybody's been running around talking to their constituents for the last few weeks. They got out of Washington, and I think they reminded what we really care about, and what we really care about is jobs. You know, I don't lay up at night worrying about the deficit. I worry about my paycheck. That's what I'm worried about. So I would like a job first. We can worry about the deficit later. And guess what? If I have a job, I'll be paying taxes, and the deficit will actually get better.
Yeah, and you add to that, you know, and you look through past recessions, especially during Republican administrations, they didn't assault the public sector. They actually increased public sector employment because they understood that. They understood that if you put people back to work, they work and they create jobs by not only, you know, paying taxes into the system, but also they spend money at local shops and, you know, like donut shops, for instance.
Exactly.
And that keeps the economy moving. But, you know, here's what gets me. You know, I saw this statement by Mitch McConnell, who said, and this is one of those moments where you go, now I know where we're heading. The scorched earth Republicans will continue on the same path. This is the Senate minority leader saying, you know, one issue I've not been conflicted about is taxes. He
yeah.
said, I wasn't sent to Washington to raise anybody's taxes to pay for more wasteful spending, and this election doesn't change my principles at all.
Well, I think, you know, it's really important to, you know, the Republicans had a lot of luck with this strategy. You know, we are going to drive this country into an emergency. I mean, they're like drunk drivers driving down the wrong side of the road, and they don't care. And, you know, I think that if Democrats stand strong, stand with the people, the public is going to be with them. But I think historically in recent years, the Republicans have had a stronger spine. We just need to change that. We need to be the ones with the line in the sand.
Well, I think
line in the sand needs to be jobs first, no cuts. That's got to be our line in the sand.
But here again, you know, it comes back to Republicans know they've got time on their side. They know that if they stall and they gridlock and they do all these things, all of this evilness is going to happen. The big fiscal cliff is going to collapse right on us because they've set that up. I mean, this crisis, again, another one of these manufactured crises by people who believe in scorched earth. And if government doesn't work the way it's supposed to, they win because they go, see, look, it doesn't work. I mean, granted, we're the ones who screwed it up.
Right, but not only that, you know what they have on their side? They have Wall Street. So what's going to happen is Wall Street is going to start to get nervous, and Moody's is going to start to downgrade, and then there'll be this fake crisis. I mean, this is the problem, is that business has this huge lever, and then everyone will run around wringing their hands and say, oh, my stocks are going down. And because the elite run America, to their member of Congress and, you know, to everyone they know, that they like Social Security. They want to keep Social Security. They like Medicare. They want to keep Medicare. I mean, you know, literally these important programs are going to get cut unless people...
Well, if you've seen the reports, but you look around... There are a number elected. We're firing our workforce.
You know what they could do? They could go out and hire people. That's what they could do instead of hoarding their money. But that's not what they do.
Or hiding it offshore.
Right, or hiding it offshore.
And exactly. I still want to see Romney's tax returns. He can call me small-minded. I still want to know what's in there. I still want to know what tax avoidance measures he used so we know how to go and close those loopholes up, all of that stuff. So people like him pay their share of taxes. I mean, it's
well, the amazing thing is that he had to purposefully overpay so that he wouldn't look bad. He had to purposefully overpay. He didn't take his deduction, which he could have taken for giving to a religious institution like he did. And he didn't because he didn't want to seem like the plutocrat that he is. Luckily, America saw through that. The funny thing is that I do think that there's a lot more focus because of Romney so embodied the one percenters. I mean, I really think that his campaign was a gift because you look at Occupy and all of the talk about inequality, and then the Romney campaign came on the heels of that, and he just embodied the 1%, and it really gave people who don't know a lot of rich people just a window into their world to see how much these people spend on horses, how much these people spend on cars, how much, and I don't begrudge them. Good for them. They keep the economy going too if they actually spend it. But the fact that he only paid 14% of taxes when he was trying to pay just tells you how unfair the system is and it needs to be changed.
Yeah. And as you've said, you don't begrudge them with their horses and their cars and their subterranean, or their parking garage. But the reality is we've got people in this country who are going hungry at night. We've got people who are losing their homes. We've got some serious problems. And to have someone like him who, had he filed his taxes the way or not, he would have paid 9% federal tax. That almost put him into the 47% he could care less about.
Right, absolutely.
So let me ask you this, Liz. Hold on.
Go ahead.
Now that he's done, now that it's over, and we're never going to see his tax returns, I understand that. How long do you think it'll take, and will we ever find out if he goes back and refiles so that 14% that he paid will be the 9% he was supposed to pay?
I don't really. I mean, if he's a private citizen, I don't care what he pays in taxes, right? I mean, what the service that he did by bringing this issue to the country right before. There's, hopefully going to be some sort of tax reform. I think it's good. Who cares what the guy makes now? The interesting issue, though, that I wanted to bring up, Rick, is look at what happened in this election. It's enormously exciting. But I think progressives have a mandate now. Tammy Baldwin won in Wisconsin. This is, someone who's an open lesbian, liberal, left. She ran on protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I mean, it's super exciting, I think.
I'm with you. And a lot of the races across, Elizabeth Warren, another race that I'm extremely happy about. Do you think she'll get put on the banking committee?
I sure hope so. And the funny thing is that the Wall Street worked very hard to make sure Elizabeth Warren did not get to head the agency that she invented, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. And, I have a feeling she's going to have more power as a senator than she ever would have had at the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. So I hope the Wall Street lobbyists, realize that they overreached and they made a big mistake. And in fact, the country's better off for it. So.
Yeah. And earlier on we were saying, the reality is what's happened in this country is the Tea Party, I think, was probably one of the worst things that happened to the Republicans for this election because people saw just how radical they were. And
yeah.
I've been saying for the longest time, be a Republican, but at least have some sanity. And I've used the Eisenhower quote a number of times where he had written to his brother Edgar saying, anybody who's against Social Security or labor unions or unemployment insurance, their numbers are negligible and they're stupid. And the sad reality is for a while, and maybe even now, stupid's running the Republican Party.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny. I never thought I would say anything nice about mainstream Republicans, but, when they let people like Aiken and Murdoch beat them, they lost Senate seats. And, it is good news for those of us on the left. I think it's a cautionary tale for activist progressives who, are kind of to the left like I am because, obviously the candidates that I like are pretty far left. And I think it's important to take the long view and look at electability in the general election and not just look at electability in the primary because the Tea Party really did hurt the Republican Party. And Congress and the Senate in particular is more liberal because of the Tea Party. And so I think, having the long view, we need to take a deep breath and look and go, okay, we want progressives to run in primaries. We want to have more liberal members of Congress, more activist members of Congress. But we need to make sure that the people who we suggest and the people we recommend are in fact electable by the general public because, you know, it's you don't want to sabotage your own wing of the party.
All right, but here's the thing, and you know, you could talk to a lot of the most progressive. You know, you brought up Tammy Baldwin and Elizabeth Warren. I got to be honest, and maybe it's just my perspective, but I look at them as more willing to compromise and more willing to come to an agreement than I would ever see Senator Lee from Utah or Senator Paul from Kentucky. These far right ideologues who they've staked their ground. They are never going to compromise. Even someone like McConnell who's saying, you know what, I'm not doing it. It's not going to happen. I'm not raising taxes. And you're not going to bring him kicking and screaming to the party. I don't ever think that happens.
Well, I think it's true, and I think it's good and bad, right? I mean, the problem with Democrats is we're honestly too reasonable, right? I mean, that's sometimes the problem with President Obama.
Yeah.
We care too much about the country. We're too conscientious, and it means that we're terrible negotiators. Whereas the Republicans are willing to ruin the country for their ideology. And I mean, it means that sometimes they are better negotiators. I don't know what the solution is. You know, do you want to act like you're a drunk driver and willing to take everybody down like the Republicans act? I don't know what the solution to that is.
Well, I mean, the reality is you're right. They're willing to pull the trigger when they put the gun against your head because it doesn't matter. It's them. I mean, it's like my 2-year-old.
Yeah.
When my daughter was 2, you know, she had this mentality, I want what I want and nothing else matters.
Yeah.
And
you
just can't stop it.
Best age ever.
Yes.
2 years old is the best.
She's 4 now. It's a good age still. We had a nice day to get together today. And she's just adorable. But, you know, last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, the reality is this fiscal cliff that really I say is manufactured and is not as big a deal as they're making it out to be is kind of serious. I mean, if we don't come to some agreement, and there's a very simple agreement for me, we say, okay, well, if we can't agree on that top 2% and raising their taxes, at least make sure that we keep the rates the same for the 98%. And then you could argue down the road next year if you have to. For the other 2%. Any chance of that happening?
I don't know. I mean, it sounded like what the president was saying today is that he's going to dig in on middle class and lower income, you know, no raise in taxes for middle class and lower income. And he is going to push for higher taxes for the wealthy. But the rub is, you know, they can say whatever they want, both sides in speeches. But the reality of how legislation is made, you know, any taxation has to start in the Ways and Means Committee.
Right.
So the president can say anything he wants, but if it's a tax, it's got to come out of the Ways and Means Committee. And, you know, I think that obviously the House is a Republican House. The House is very much run by, you know, crazy right-wing Republicans who are really bad news. So, you know, no matter who says they want tax reform, the reality when you know, when the sausage making, when the legislation happens, I mean, something the public, it's boring and it's wonky, but, you know, I certainly urge everybody to pay a lot of attention to the details.
Yeah. Yeah, but as he pointed out, he said, you know, the Senate already passed a bill that would have, you know, extended those tax cuts for the bottom 98%. It was the House that hasn't done anything on it.
Right.
But basically putting the pressure back onto the Republicans to actually get something done. And work. I'm skeptical.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I hope that Republicans come back a little bit chastened from the election. I cannot imagine that they didn't notice the Democratic gains on Tuesday.
And if they don't want to get their behinds kicked in 2 more years, they better come to the table. You're right. Liz Rose, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Always great talking. Liz Rose, Communications Director over at the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Quick break. Right back after this with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
When you fit in, take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Are you tired of hearing we can't invest in improving our roads and rebuilding our bridges? Are you tired of the argument we can't invest in our children's future by funding education? The mainstream corporate-controlled message we're being force-fed is we're broke. Sorry, can't fund education, we're broke. Sorry, we can't have a 21st century infrastructure. We're broke. Sorry, can't have access to quality health care for all. We're broke. Well, we're not broke. We can invest. We can build a better tomorrow. To find out how, join the Rick Smith Show Saturday, October 6th at the Cumberland County Democratic Headquarters, 46 West Lowther Street in Carlton.
Today, I am notifying the honchos of Bain Capital, Blackstone Group, and other big-time private equity funds that my little company, Saddlebur Productions, can be had for a price. I published this notice in response to a recent news item revealing that these funds have a perplexing problem. They have too much money on hand. In all, they're holding $1 trillion that super-rich speculators have entrusted to them. Private equity funds are corporate predators that borrow from the rich and then buy out targeted corporations, dismantle them, and sell off the parts for a fat profit. However, in these iffy economic times, these flush funds have hesitated to do big takeovers, so they're sitting on all that cash, which they refer to as dry powder. Under the rules of this high-stakes casino game, however, firms have to spend their borrowed money by a set time or give it back, and the clock is ticking. So, using Wall Street's macho lingo, the big players have announced that they're ready to go elephant hunting and are prepared to fire big bucks to bag some companies. To which I say, fire away at Saddlebur Productions. Okay, my company is hardly an elephant, but maybe it could be what the equity hucksters refer to as a hot potato. That's when one firm grabs a company just to sell it to another firm, which might pass it off to yet another. They are expected to spend more than $22 billion this year selling hot potatoes to each other, in part just to move cash out the door so they don't have to give it back. This is Jim Hightower saying, believe it or not, this is what passes for good business sense in the truly screwy world of private equity. All they're doing is churning money, producing absolutely nothing. Except, of course, huge fees for the churners. Think what good that $22 billion would do if it were put into the real economy. But if that's the game, hey, put me in the mix. $1 billion sounds about right.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So right around this time, back in 1933, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt announced plans to create the Civil Works Administration. And what did the Civil Works, the CWA, what did it actually do? It created about 4 million jobs. Because if you remember, you go back to the Depression, we had a jobs problem. We had a jobs crisis. So government stepped in, created about 4 million jobs. And what did those workers do? Well, they laid about 12 million feet of sewer pipe. Built or, you know, substantially improved about more than 250,000 miles of roads. They built 40,000 plus schools, 3,700 playgrounds, 1,000 airports, you know, and all kinds of other things that the nation desperately needed. And I look at right now, we have been in that kind of a situation for some time. And I've been saying, well, since the Bush collapse, this is what we need. We need a modern day CWA. We need a modern day WPA. The Public Works Administration to say, you know what, we've got sewer lines that need to be replaced. We've got power lines, a grid that needs to be replaced. We've got so much stuff that needs to be done that is just being put off and put off and put off, and we're bubblegumming things together. We have an opportunity. We need a jobs plan. We need someone who's going to say, we're going to invest in our nation. And I loved when Bush came to office. You know, he ran out, we're not into nation building yet. What did we do over in Iraq and Afghanistan? Nation building. And I think the president's right. Let's do some nation building right here. I mean, you go into some of the what used to be our industrial powerhouses. And I was just telling somebody the other day, You know, I went home to Cleveland a couple of months back, and, you know, I drove down Brook Park Road, which is where the Chevy and the Ford plant used to, the Ford plant used to be. They're now tearing huge parts of it down. So on one side of the street, you've got these two behemoth factories that were churning out automobiles for a couple of generations. But across the street, across Brook Park, you had hundreds of small businesses that fed into those behemoths, that employed 10, 20 machinists, 10, 20 tool and die makers, 10, 20 punch operators. But all up and down that road, you had small business feeding into that. You had manufacturing capacity. And I go back and I stop and think about, you know, what could be our modern day jobs plan? Well, I mean, you think about the Department of Defense, and you know where Romney was partially right. We need a stimulus and feeding our war machine. There are a lot of things that don't get made because we've allowed the Chinese to come in and buy us up because we keep buying stuff from them. And they like to have us believe in, well, you know, the Chinese are, we're borrowing money from the Chinese. And some of that is true. But the bigger problem is our trade deficit. And I know, you're obsessed with the trade deficit. You're right, I am. Because that's what's buying us. That's what's destroying our standard of living as well. As the world's reserve currency, the more money we send over there, the more money that they have to buy us, because it has to come back. And you look at Sensata technology, you know, pack it up, go to China. Why? More profit. So I saw this story of the bionic wrench, which I got to be honest, last year I wanted my wife to get. Saw the bionic wrench. It looked, I love little gadgets. I love weird little tools. And this one looked fantastic. And it's got really a very kind of weird way of gripping. It'll grip any nut. And I wanted her to get it. I'm going, it's made in the U.S. It's fantastic. It's made by the folks over at Penn Technologies, right here in Pennsylvania. Penn United Technologies, right here in Pennsylvania. So it sounded like, hey, this is a great thing. Turns out, the bionic wrench now has a competitor. It's the Axis Tools. Max Axis or whatever it's called, made in China. And the story goes like this. This guy from Chicago who, teaches industrial design came up with this wrench after seeing his son work on a lawnmower. Sees the kid working on the lawnmower, sees him struggling, comes up with this design for this wrench that will grab any nut or bolt. And it's because it's multi-pronged. He got the idea from a camera. The shutter on a camera. So he comes up with this, he patents it, he finds someone to manufacture it, he sells it to Sears. Sears buys a bunch of them, it takes off. People say, well, $24.99, that's too expensive. And even I say, that's a bit pricey, I still want one though. Made in the U.S., something I can use, absolutely, sign me right up. Well, now you see that Craftsman, who I always thought was made in the U.S. I'm not sure when the conversion, because that was that when I were there, wasn't that one of their sales pitches? It's guaranteed for life and it's made in the U.S. Is it guaranteed for life anymore? I don't even know. But I thought all Craftsman tools were made in the U.S. Evidently, not happening. So this new Craftsman tool, it's called the Max Access. It is virtually identical to the bionic wrench. And it's made in China. And you look at this and you go, here, like the guy said, this is, you want to know why we can't create jobs in this country? All of the innovation that we create here has to be shipped overseas because you've got these companies who are cutting each other's throats for pennies and moving all this manufacturing overseas because we've got insane trade agreements. So this guy went through all of this paperwork, all of this expense to patent it, and it's been ripped off over in China. We've got really no way of stopping that. And look, the guy's going to file a lawsuit, and he's probably going to win, but how many years down the road, and will his business be, will he be around? And you look at this Penn United Technologies, who was, you know, making the bionic wrench here in Pennsylvania. They had to lay off 31 workers because, hey, we don't, Sears stopped ordering the product. We're getting it from China under the Craftsman brand. And here's the kicker. You know, I got to the end of the article, and here's the kicker for me. The company that makes the Max Access Wrench and other tools for Craftsman is a company called Apex Tool Group. And I thought Craftsman Tools made their own tools. Tells you how far I've been out of the Craftsman loop. Now made by Access Tool Group. Well, it's being, as we speak, acquired by Bain Capital. I mean, think of the irony. And when I read that, I go, you know what? Thank goodness Tuesday went the way it did. Because all of the tough talk, all of the rhetoric, all of the, we're going to label them manipulators and all of that nonsense, all of that chest thumping, was, I think, would have been just that. Because I look at the spawn of his loin, I think of, and I know he's not the CEO of Bain Capital, but you know what? He set its course. He set the direction of that company. And I truly don't believe a leopard changes his spots. So I'm going to start looking. I'm going to buy myself a bionic wrench. I've got to find one now. This will be my quest. I've got to have one of these. And I'm distraught over the Craftsman deal. Because here I always thought, you know, made in America, the Craftsman brand. But then there's part of me that goes, well, this is what our insane trade policies have done to this, to all of us. And now you find out that Sears isn't even selling the bionic wrench. They've got some online, but not in the store. And what people have always told me is, Rick, you know, there's the free market. There's the free market. They should be able to compete. Well, okay, but show me where they can compete. Because they're not sitting on the shelf next to each other. They're not. And I think that's a serious problem. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick.
America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Earth, sky.
When lightning strikes, it makes waves that can be seen from space. That's according to satellite researchers with NASA.
The researchers described it as a repeating heartbeat of our planet. Flashes of earthly lightning leaking out into space and making these waves.
According to NASA, Earth has about 2,000 thunderstorms at any given moment. Together, these storms produce about 50 flashes of lightning every second. Each lightning burst creates electromagnetic waves that bounce off the atmosphere and encircle the Earth. Most of these waves are trapped inside Earth's ionosphere, a layer of the atmosphere about 60 miles or 100 kilometers up.
If the lightning waves have just the right wavelength, though, some of the waves combine in the atmosphere and increase in strength like ripples in a pond. Physicists call this the Schumann resonance, but they hadn't seen it until now. An instrument aboard a U.S. Air Force satellite detected these waves created by lightning flashes in Earth's atmosphere that had leaked out into space.
Scientists say this discovery opens up possibilities to study lightning, thunderstorms, and Earth's atmosphere from above. For more, visit earthsky.org and search for the words lightning waves. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. Needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
Yeah, you bet it's tough. I'm not sure, the education part or the speech part. Not quite sure, but, you know, hey, I do miss him, too. In fact, I really miss Alan West. And I've already missed him. He's not out of Congress yet, but he's on his way. The Hill reported today that yesterday the West campaign sent a letter to the St. Lucie County Supervisor of Elections detailing serious questions and that have arisen as part of the campaign, part of the voting. Specifically, The Hill says the campaign detailed a series of questions regarding the claimed malfunction of memory cards in the optical scanners during the first 3 days of early voting. And I go back and I think, well, hold on, wasn't he one of the people who wanted to get rid of all of that? Don't we want people to vote? Wouldn't it be hysterical if he actually, because he's threatening to sue. Wouldn't it be hysterical if he sued and we actually went to court to extend voting rights to everyone? Not going to happen. But, you know, here's the thing. If he didn't get his answer by noon today, he was going to kick and scream, cry and whine. So I'm waiting. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. Victoria, what do you think? Alan West going to expand voting rights? Very unhappy about cards.
Yes. Amazing, isn't it? Joe Walsh is another one. What are we going to do?
I'm going to miss. West is, he's off on one fringe of the yellow, but West is just a kook.
West was just a treat, really.
Yeah. Well, truly neither of them should have any power.
No, they shouldn't. They should not have any power whatsoever. So this is righteous.
Yeah, it's a sad testament, though, that to our country that they both were there once. Once was too much. And now I look at this thing with I lost by 2,500 votes, 2,600, and now we're going to impound the voting machines, and we're going to do all the legal stuff, and, do what you got to do. I understand the Supreme Court's going to hear a challenge to the Voting Rights Act.
Yes, it is. It's going to be on the constitutionality of the provision that requires lawmakers in 16 states with a history of discrimination at the polls to obtain federal approval before altering state election laws.
Because they've learned their lesson? I mean, is that the argument? Well, we've learned our lesson. We won't suppress those people anymore, those others. We've learned. Kind of like the bankers learned not to crash the economy again.
Yes, Shelby County, Alabama, 23 miles southeast of Birmingham, says that the Voting Rights Act is outdated and that they've made progress since its inception in 1965, and they're the ones appealing it. And the court's going to be hearing it in February, ruling probably in late June. And, they are very likely to rule that it may well be outdated, because they did hear a case similar to this back in 2009, a Texas case, but they didn't rule on its constitutionality. They opted instead to make it easier for local governments to seek exemptions from it. Chief Justice Roberts saying in the majority opinion the law's days may be numbered, saying we're now in a very different nation. Mm-hmm. Whether conditions continue to justify such legislation is a difficult constitutional question we do not answer today.
So what was that decision 5-4?
The decision was, it says majority.
Yeah, I'm assuming the next decision will be 5-4 as well.
Probably. Yeah. Probably. I would think so, ruling in June. But, it just depends, unless, yes, it will be, I'm sure.
Yeah, and look, you know, you get the Hispanic vote, it's rising. We're going to need to be able to suppress that in the future. So, okay, well, why not? What the heck? You know, undo all of that. Did you see the big speech today? Did you see the big presentation? The fiscal cliff, the end of civilization, the end of humanity. If we don't do something by the end of the year, it's going to be Armageddon. Did you see the big presentations?
I saw the dueling presentations, the one from the East Room and the one from the Capitol, yes.
Yeah, and what were your thoughts?
Well, I mean, these were opening salvos, opening bids by the president, who made his first public remarks since being reelected. And Speaker Boehner, they weren't his first public remarks, but he took questions the president didn't. By the way, the president will hold a press conference next Wednesday in the East Room.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, for those complainers who've been saying, like me, who has said he hasn't had one for too long. But the president did surround himself with members of the public who applauded him. And I think this is a signal that he's going to be using members of the public as props.
He's going to use people. Oh, you mean people? You mean people like...
People.
Like people. Wow, okay.
People who vote.
Wow.
And this is going to be, I think, very deliberate, because he said in a reflective interview towards the end of his first term, that he felt that he had not spoken to the people enough and with the people enough. And it's interesting that once he brought forward the American Jobs Act and started getting out on the road to promote it, his numbers started to go up once he started to connect with people again.
Yeah, well, you know, those people that pull the lever. Yeah, that's kind
people.
Of important. But, you know, at the end of it, he's not going to run for reelection again. Now it's just about the legacy. You know, but here's the thing. I look at this, and you go back to the beginning of his first term, and he was doing that. He was doing, you know, prime time from the Oval Office speeches and stuff, when he was talking to people about, hey, we're going to turn the economy around, and the Republicans just beat him up senselessly. You know, it was like, oh, he's out there, and he's talking to those people. And I thought he got rabbit ears, and he stopped. Had he continued to do that, continued to talk to the people, I think he'd have had a much easier reelection.
I think so. And I think what happens is what happens to you in Washington. You get bubbleized. You get White House-ized. You know, you get into the office, you get surrounded by a smaller group of people, and your world becomes smaller and smaller, and you don't realize it's happened to you.
Yeah, and then you wake up one day and you realize, hey, I don't know who people, I don't really like people.
Right, except that one thing he was doing, he continued to read 10 letters a day from people.
Yeah, I give him credit for that. But, you know, looking at Boehner, though, do you think it's possible for Boehner to now being in a position to maybe compromise a little bit where he wasn't before, because some of the elements like Alan West and Joe Walsh are gone, some of the Tea Party elements are gone, and their power has diminished? Do you think he'll be able to bring some of the other folks along, or is that a pipe dream?
I think he can bring some of the other folks along. I think he wants to. I think he wants to deal. He's a pragmatist. He's a conservative. But he's a pragmatist, and he's a deal maker. That's who he basically is. He's a guy who'd like to meet you in a bar over a drink and make a deal with you.
Yeah,
that's who he is.
I get the sense of that. And, you know, I got the sense that he was really held hostage in the last term by the crazy element. I never thought he was
right.
All that crazy.
No, he's not crazy at all.
But the elements that were holding him hostage, that Tea Party caucus. Will it be another Tea Party caucus? Is Michelle Bachmann going to be sitting in a room by herself?
Well, yeah, now once she's licked her wounds, she will be. I think so, even though he said in that interview with Diane Sawyer there isn't a Tea Party caucus. There is a Tea Party caucus, and they are back. And they are diminished slightly, but they are still there, and they believe, because of the gerrymandering of the districts, that they are there to represent their districts over and above the United States of America, some of them.
Oh, man, you look at the gerrymandering of this state. You know, Obama took the state by over 5%. Casey won the state by over 9%. Democrats won all of the statewide offices, yet congressionally and the congressional districts, only 5 of the 18 went to Democrats.
Really?
You look at the map of this state, and there are little specks where the Democrats, where you have high population, and the rest of the state looks all red, looks like somebody dropped a couple of drops of blue on it. All because of our legislature, who did a masterful job of map manipulation, gerrymandering, if you will. Just masterful. Did you see General Petraeus resigned? Was it you?
No, it was not me. It was not I. It was his biographer.
Oh, okay.
Paula Broadwell is her name, and, yeah.
Come on. The man who is known for the Surge?
I'm sorry. And he's considered a really straightforward, honest, upright man. And I think he is. Yeah, but, you know, he was. She was doing his biography. She was doing a lot more than his biography. She was embedded in...
embedded?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. You got another one in there.
I can...
Go ahead, bang through them.
I'm not going to do it. But anyway, she was in Afghanistan for a year.
Okay.
Doing his biography, and they were going on 5-mile runs together. Apparently, he does that with other people, too. But people were noticing they were spending a lot of time. People also felt that the way she wrote the biography was really like almost like a love letter to him. It was so uncritical. And so there were questions being raised. And this only apparently, so far, the story is very new. But this only came to light because there was some kind of FBI investigation, apparently, that seems to have been into her getting unauthorized access to his emails. But why they were investigating unauthorized access to his emails is not clear. Also, I think this story could get bigger because, you know, why was the FBI investigating that, I think, is an interesting part of the story. Also, why is that happening now? We're told the president didn't know about this until Wednesday, but did somebody else know about this before, and were they sitting on it during the campaign so as not to embarrass the president?
Interesting.
And it also means that he will not be testifying on Benghazi next week in a closed-door hearing. It means that his deputy, who's taking over for him, will be testifying, and they had really wanted him to testify at this closed-door hearing on Benghazi.
So, conspiracy?
Well, believe me, if you go to the red blogs out there, it's Conspiracy Central, which it already was. But in this case, I do have to say that they really are leaving themselves wide open to question.
Yeah. And the first thing I thought of is the ghost of J. Edgar Hoover has taken over the FBI because, you know, evidently we need sex lives. I got to be honest. I really don't care. I don't care where the general puts his little soldier.
I don't care either. I think in this case, the only reason that it mattered was because they placed so much emphasis on the risk of agents being blackmailed over their own sex lives that they didn't feel, apparently, this is what the official line is, that the head of this CIA could get away with an affair.
But here's the thing. I mean, you know, if we didn't care, I mean, if honestly, as a society, if we got over this whole puritanical nonsense of caring who people are sleeping with and be adults about the whole thing and say, you know what, it happens.
I agree.
Would we?
I totally agree with you.
I mean, I just got so tired of this. Look, the guy's human. You know, it happens.
I agree. I don't think it's anybody's business at all.
I mean,
except his wife.
Exactly. It's between the same thing with Clinton. Did I care about? I didn't. The lie I kind of cared about. You know, you can't have a president lying. But you know, at the end of it, he should have never been asked the question. And I should care less. Who's
I just felt it was between him and Hillary and, you know, and the girl. It was nobody else's business.
Yeah, I mean, just get over it. Jeez, worry about yourself for a change. Did you see that Donald claims he has no regrets?
No regrets.
About his Tuesday meltdown and all the tweets? Evidently, he deleted.
Really? He has no regrets, and yet he deleted the tweets.
Yeah, he deleted the tweets, has no regrets. And you know why he has no regrets? Because he's a media whore.
That's correct.
And in the world where it doesn't matter if it's good or bad as long as it is publicity, that's where he lives.
That's right. And yet he deleted the tweets, but he has no regrets.
None whatsoever. In fact, you know, he went after Brian Williams, who said that I guess something along the lines, he's passed the last exit of relevance or relevance.
Yeah, he did.
And then the Donald, everything, I'm right on that. Does he do anything but tweet? I mean, the guy seems to have a lot of time for someone who's supposed to be creating jobs and being the world leader.
I think he's given up on that. I think all he does is talk in 140 characters now.
Well, it is what it is. Lastly, it looks like, what's going on in Hardin County, Texas?
Hardin County, Texas is in the southeast part of the state, and it's kind of interesting. There's a party official there who is the Hardin County Republican Treasurer, Peter Morrison, a Ron Paul supporter, and author of a race-heavy Tea Party newsletter. And he's calling for Texas to separate. Let each go her own way and demands an amicable divorce from the U.S. and from the maggots who reelected President Obama.
Nice.
He is also calling for Texas to fight in hopes that Providence might shine upon our cause. He's particularly angry at Asian Americans and Hispanics who backed Obama, accusing them of voting on an ethnic basis. They reelected Obama. He's their president. Oh, and he was also chosen by former State Board of Education chairman to help screen Texas public school textbooks.
You're kidding, right?
No, this is true.
Oh, we're in trouble. We are in such trouble as a nation. When folks like this hold public office, I mean, I don't know. That's a good way to start the weekend. Victoria, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Look forward to it next week.
Our good friend Victoria Jones. Quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms, crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Oh,
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of our program, download the podcast there at the website, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone, take the program on the go. Under the heading of, boy, you know, when you're poor, when you're broke, when you don't have any money, it's really expensive. You know, I had someone tell me, you know, being poor is really expensive because, you know, everything costs more. You live in the inner city, the groceries cost more. You live in poor areas, groceries cost more. Everything costs more. It costs more to borrow money, everything. And I look at here at Harrisburg, where the city receiver, guy named General William Lynch, is mulling the idea of selling the city's right to go after and collect late real estate taxes. And evidently, the city's owed a pretty good sum of money. I think it was like $2 million, if I remember right. They're going to sell that to a private, for-profit company who will then go after and try and find these people. So the $2 million that's owed the city in back real estate taxes, from according to what Dan Miller says, who is one of the council people, or the controller. What he's saying is, look, you know, this is going to be about 10% of it's going to go to some private company. So about 200,000 of the revenue is going to go to this company who's going to put up a little bit of money. So they're going to put the 2 million, they're going to put, well, I guess 1.8 up, and they're going to collect 2, and it's going to cost the city. That's the plan anyway. And what Miller says, he says, look, it's a horrible financial mechanism. It's like a payday loan. And that's a good analogy. I think, you know, again, when you look at this stuff, desperation. And what I fear is on the federal level, you know, they've got this, the fiscal cliff, and we're heading over the edge. By having this fetish for tax cuts, this fetish to feed the 1%, the fetish to make sure that the very wealthy keep becoming more wealthy, it's starving our cities. It's starving our states. It's starving our ability to, well, just operate basic functions. And that is the plan. Now, look, Harrisburg made some dumb decisions. But here again, a lot of it was in the, well, we need to figure out how to do things on the cheap. So they tried something stupid, and they got busted doing it. But now what's going to happen? Well, what they want is they want to go and screw all those workers, and they want to go and hack off all of the city assets. Amazing stuff. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. Get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We'll see you.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming, let the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
and every nation. We